720 WGN, high atop Chicago Skyline Studio, overlooking a peaceful Chicagoland as we end up the weekend here. It is Dane with you in for Nick DiGilio, a little bit under the weather today, and alongside for the duration of the program, my favorite special guest of all time. He is, again, we'll always say, the physical embodiment of the spirit, the enthusiasm of Harry Carey, and our verified genetic link to the Nick DiGilio show as the right Larry from Aurora. All right.
Exactly. That was it. I went through some stuff recently and
really
found some old pictures of old Uncle Larry. Good stuff. Yeah, some good stuff in there.
You heard the bumper and Tom Hush, of course, in the booth for the entire program, spinning the hits and some more important, more meaningful than others. As you heard the cars there, Rick Ocasek, we lost him. I was surprised to hear that he was 75 years old, but I guess, you know, as time flies, you think back to their heyday, he would have been, you know,
in his 30s.
30s and yeah. Right, something like that, 30s and 40s. So time flies. Classics and that and Eddie Money, you know, and you look at this now Eddie Money was still performing, you know, he was still out there doing things. I think he had a reality television show. He was still doing dates, as far as I know, whereas the Cars had kind of, you know, after some of their major success, where were they? Were I think it may have been like the, was it late 80s or something like that?
Yeah,
they were big, one of the bigger bands in the world at that
time.
Yeah,
they took advantage of the video era, too. They were able to get a lot of their music on when MTV started. And, you know, they got to, you know, they were a band in the late 70s, early 80s that was, you know, just starting out and getting, cranking out a lot of hits in a row. And they took advantage of the video age and got some of their videos on. And those are ones that you remember. And, you know, it was a shock to me. I didn't realize that... you know, that he was that, you know, age-wise either. I didn't think, you know, way.
Yeah, you got to look back, though, then you think, okay, well, I guess that makes sense. But they were a band, and the kind of the point that I was getting at is that there's a lot of bands, you know, you look at whether it's the, you know, whether it's Paul McCartney or whether it's the Rolling Stones, you got, you know, people that have really gotten in but are still delivering great concerts. You know, they're still out there touring as active as ever. And the Cars, you haven't really seen it. Now, Tom, I know that you cover the music scene and you're kind of, you know, out there, not only monitoring the concerts, Nick's a big fan of music as well. Have the Cars, have they been sort of dormant for a while? Have they been doing shows?
Well, I mean, most of the members of the Cars, the ones that were still with us at this point, I mean, Rick was well known in the 90s for producing, I think, a couple of records by Weezer.
Really?
Yeah, he was involved with them because the folks in Weezer were really big fans of the Cars. They were obviously a huge influence on them. But I won't lie to you. Like, the Cars have always been a band that I've been aware of, I've enjoyed, but everybody else is a much bigger fan than I. I never really dug super deep into them. And, you know, with the passing of any great musician, it gives you an opportunity to reflect and maybe catch up on a lot of things that you were kind of sleeping on. I know the hits, you know, but I never really...
You just went Zoolander on me.
Yeah. I know the hits. But, you know, I don't have a copy of Candy O at home. You know, I don't have a copy of the debut.
That's a great album cover.
Yeah, I do have that at home, actually. Yeah. But I'm a lot older than Tom, so.
Well, but still, no, I think that a lot of that music's timeless. We're going to hear, and I'm sure over the course of this week and in the coming weeks, we're going to hear a lot of that and kind of people kind of retrospecting on, you know, like the impact and the legacy and all that stuff. And I'm sure we'll hear a number of different selections on the bumper side as well. 312-981-7200. If you want to text in or call in with your favorite, if you got a chance to see the Cars in concert, I actually worked some of those concerts in I've been like the late 80s or something at Alpine Valley. I know they had a tour that came through. But if you've got, you know, some songs that you'd like to hear, I think Tom would probably add them into the bumper as well. One thing he was also known for, I thought, because, you know, not a traditionally attractive man. I remember Rick Ocasek, but Paulina Porizkova, right? One of the more popular.
Supermodel.
And that was, I'm sure people, you know, rock stars, supermodels since the beginning of time, but that was one that I think made a lot of news as well. Are they still together? Do you know offhand, Tom? I know you get your hand on the pulse of the relationship scene.
They were separated or divorced recently.
Oh, sorry to hear that.
Well, I could do a little half-assed internet research, see if we can...
That sounds like
a
segment.
No, I'm almost positive that's true.
Now it's cyber, half-assed.
But we'll have Tom confirm that.
So when... When it comes to that, or full, right, or even, you know, lovely ladies out there, you know, making entertainment for the masses, and some that's been very highly acclaimed. And we talked a little bit about it, I think, off the air with Carl and Lisa, is the movie Hustlers with J-Lo. You know, she's been out there in a bunch of romantic comedies. She's known for that. She's great for those. And she's made a movie now that, I don't know, I think there's probably some light moments in it. I remember talking with Dean Richards last week about his review for it. Highly regarded. You know, he thought it was great. There's, but here it's the story of, I think this is during the financial apocalypse of the, you know, 2008, 2009, these are the strippers of the Wall Street zone or whatever, and somehow the trials and tribulations and maybe some triumphs, right? As they kind of make their way through the world. And but I guess it's good. So Blake Stubbs went to the movies tonight.
And he had a working assignment. He's out on the road.
Like he goes, I'll run in. This was because we just, for the listeners out there, we, you know, 312-981-7200, your thoughts on some, we got some pizza we're going to talk about. We're going to talk with Blake. We're going to talk a little barbecue. We're going to talk some travel. But we didn't really know we were coming in to do this until after 9 o'clock. And so when I got a hold of Blake saying, hey, do you want to, there's some movies out. I knew Hustler was out. I didn't know if he had seen it, not seen it. And Blake, because of the dedication to the program and the opportunity and just his love of movies and talking about them and sharing it with the listeners, which is exemplary, he said, I'm going to get out there and see Hustler.
Moved right to the top of the list.
So for the people down there in Peoria, you saw like a guy out of breath busting in saying,
running in.
I'll take a popcorn and a Diet Coke in a front row seat. Stat. You know, that was Blake Stubbs.
So he was checking it out, and yeah, I've heard some good things as well about that movie. And J-Lo just turning 50 recently, and they had a big party for her, apparently. And
you know, wait, she's 50 years old?
Yep, 5-0.
Rico Kasich, 75. How old is Paulina Poroskova?
She's got to be 60.
She's 89. Yeah, so that's
more research for Tom.
Right. He's already working out on their relationship. Well, she's seeing an investment banker, you know, at this point. Well, some of the other things we're going to talk about, Eddie Money, for sure, 312-981-7200, your favorite Eddie Money songs. He's one of those guys that, you know, he's been out there. He's got sort of that really approachable, humble, everyman kind of vibe. All the people that have talked about him said that, you know, without exception, he was, you know, a great guy, you know, non-pretentious. But when you listen to some of the kind of the body of the work, you get the Two Tickets to Paradise. Everybody can think about that. But he's got a lot of hits.
Yeah, there were a lot of Take Me Home Tonight was another one, that one of my favorites. And yeah, he had a lot of great songs. And I don't know, he just, all of a sudden, they went in and got a checkup, and he had stage 4 esophageal cancer. And that's just...
Really? So he didn't find out about it till...
I don't think he knew he was... I mean, he may have known he was, like, sick, but I don't think he knew the extent of it until he finally went in and got it checked out.
We're going to talk about that. I know that we've got some of the information here as we sort of navigate through that. And what would you think? That sounds like... And it's kind of a little bit morbid to talk about, but, I mean, a part of, I think, the... You know, that process of being sick and going through all of that, I'm sure it's very stressful. It's maybe just mentally how it works on your psyche, that the whole time you feel like, especially if it's, you know, a tough cancer that's in a later stage, if you can't get in there and stop it and do something about it, is maybe that whole process of dealing with it. And it might, I don't know if he had the choice to think about it a different way. It might almost be nice to just be like, okay. You know, not have to deal with, like, months and months.
Right. I mean, this is what I've got, and this is how much time I have left, and then that's basically it.
Well, it's kind of like David Bowie. He didn't tell anybody that he was sick publicly until he was already gone.
So, but did he know in advance?
I think he definitely did, because his final album, Black Star, is more or less him saying goodbye to everyone, saying goodbye to everyone in his life, goodbye to his fans. The whole thing is very ominous. And when it came out, people heard it and they were like, oh, this sounds very final. Sounds very like, this is it for me. Yeah. I'm saying goodbye. And then he literally died weeks later, maybe. And people were just shocked, and they went back and listened to the album Black Star and said he was telling us the whole time.
Yep.
He was telling,
he knew it.
Writing was on the wall.
Wow. And you wonder, for a person like David Bowie or like a number of these other individuals or ones that we've seen, but David Bowie specifically, because you've mentioned that he knew and decided to keep it to himself, when so much of your life is public, and so much of, I think, what you're doing is trying to either navigate or steer or shape, you know, your image to the public or how they perceive you, as opposed to that whole, you know, the outpouring of support. And I think some people probably appreciate and need that, maybe. But for him to do that, where he just decided, you know, I don't want that whole part of it, you know, months and months of, am I dead yet? you know, or whatever would go along with it, you know, and the outpouring from the fans of concern or that kind of public real-time mourning. Maybe that was something he wasn't interested in, right, or didn't want to be part of everybody's. Because here's the thing, too, is I think, you know, the body of the work in his career and all those things that he did meant to people. You know, if there's like a prolonged illness for like 6-8 months and that's everybody's like kind of baked into everybody's relationship, you know, with him and the thought process and the fan side of things, maybe it skews it where like he's the guy that was sick for a long time as opposed to whatever else he wanted to be known for. What do you think?
Well, I mean, no one wants their sickness to take over who they are. Especially someone like David Bowie, who has the artistic legacy that he has. He's a chameleon. He's done everything. He's gone from, like, he's done folk, he's done industrial, he's done glam rock, he's done soul, you know. He's a man that influenced every artist he can name in one way or another, whether it was his fashion or the music itself or just the way he approached artistry. So, you know, he seemed like the kind of guy that wanted to have these last few moments, you know, under control and say, I'm going to go out with an artistic statement and then people can mourn and do all that kind of stuff later.
Right.
This, I want to be my standing legacy, not, this public idea of watching David Bowie waste away.
Well, and you never know. There may have been a part of him that thought there was a chance that he could overcome it and didn't want it to be kind of part of the narrative as well. So we'll talk about that and get your thoughts. 312-981-7200. We're going to talk about a bunch of things coming up on the movie side. Of course, this is what Nick usually talks about on Sunday nights, Monday mornings. We're going to go into some of those movies. We have Blake Stubbs coming up a little bit after the bottom of the hour. So keep it here. It's Dane in for Nick, 720 WGN. WGN. It is Dane here with you in the Skyline Studio high atop Chicago until 5 a.m. in for Nick DiGilio in a time when I know it's been a number of days. Rick Ocasek, of course, was just recently, maybe yesterday, maybe today. I can't, you know, remember, but it was just very, very recently. And of course, Eddie Money, I think, happened where people were talking about it a little bit on Friday. And part of his story, too, is, you know, when I think about, okay, the Eddie Money, I remember the thing that he did. You know, some of the songs that he had in the 80s, but he still was out there doing, and his songs were kind of, I don't want to say kind of, they were timeless, right? They're the kind of things that weren't necessarily just linked to like that time period where they would fall out of fashion or be out of style. There's still, you know, songs that I think are popular on the classic rock type today. And then he came at it from sort of a different perspective. This is the guy that, I mean, Dino, wasn't he like a New York City cop or something? And then, right, it wasn't like he didn't have a typical theater background,
right?
Or didn't, you know, he wasn't just 18, 19, you know, in a punk band or something like that. This was a guy that was like living, had a regular career and then became a rock star.
Got a job and then became a rock star, absolutely. That's, you know, one of those stories that's a made-for-TV special right there. That's something else. But he had a great career and, like, you know, a lot of good songs and, you know, just a shame that, you know, we lost, you know, two guys in the rock and roll business within days of each other at the within the last couple of days here. So
312-981-7200, we'll be able to talk about other people on the rockstar side that we've lost, had lost, not necessarily super recently, but out of the blue that maybe people, you know, had. I don't want to say, you know, where you have sort of a reaction to. There's some things that happen, you know, and we always watch those videos at the end of the year, whether it's the Oscars or some of the people we've lost, right. You know, and they have this sort of slideshow. And depending, I guess, on your level of success or prominence or whoever's making the slideshow, if they happen to like you, then maybe you're up there for a couple seconds. And some people, like, they just kind of blip through. Like,
well, there was the controversy about Dennis Farina when, you know, after he had passed and they didn't include him. And
he didn't make the cut.
He wasn't on there. And there was a lot of uproar about that. After
now, did they say that was a mistake? Or was that just like, oh,
I don't know if anybody ever even admitted anything about it happened. Okay. It was like, oh, well, okay. Sorry.
Yeah. So, but you always watch that, and there's people that have just kind of passed by in the stream of situational information where you're like, oh, wow. Oh, okay. All right. Oh, yeah. I didn't even know about that.
I remember that.
That
guy. I didn't know he passed
away.
Yeah,
we didn't necessarily know about it. Sure. And so, and Tom had brought up David Bowie, an icon in the music world, like you said, so influential in a bunch of different ways. And a handful of, a couple years ago, and I think, Dino, you were in with me when Prince had passed away, and we talked a little bit about the impact. Huge, right? You know, as far as the
cultural and everything with them. He was
the influences, and some of them had personalities that were really big, you know, on the influence side. And I'm wondering where the Cars are going to fit. You mentioned, you know, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame last year? For the Cars and for Rick Ocasek. I mean, part of it, I think, is understated personality. Because I can't really describe to you when it comes to like Eddie Money or Prince or David Bowie. I can imagine them doing interviews and talking, things like that. Like Rick Ocasek, I can't imagine what you'd even talk to him about, like the weather. He spoke through his music, but you don't know his personality.
Yeah, he didn't really seem to let on a lot about himself as far as away from the music. And, you know, obviously he was married to a supermodel, but beyond that.
Who found him, Dino, like the intrepid reporter, Dino Tiberi, found that Paulina Poretskova and Tom Hush, as he's scouring the internet for juicy gossip style tidbits, found that they had, you know, broken up a long time ago, but still remained close, at least in this instance.
Yeah, because apparently Paulina Poretskova was at his bedside when she found him unresponsive. So,
well, just the fact that she's involved, they've been
kids. I mean,
they
together,
do have five kids, but still, just the fact that she's the one that finds him. Five kids, they've been divorced. I think that's a situation calculated for maximum suspense.
Throwback there.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, it's one of those things. So yeah, it's we're going to talk about 312-981-7200. I know when Tom Petty passed away, it was something that you had mentioned. And that's a guy, too, that is, I don't know as far as how many other musicians that he had influenced, but certain... For the fan perspective and the longevity of the career and the hits, you know, Tom Petty was one of those really great ones, and that was one that I think had an impact on you.
Yeah, it did. You know, I got to see his last show, or when he was on the 40th anniversary tour, and I caught him up in Milwaukee at Summerfest, and he was excellent that night, and I just had no idea it was going to be, well, no one did, obviously, but, you know, it was just crazy to think that he would be gone, you know, so soon after that. Mm. Well, you know, when you saw that, and you know, you said influences, you know, he performed with a lot of different, you know, other musical.
The Traveling Wilburys.
Yeah, that was a big one, you know, and, you know, Stevie Nicks, that song, you know, many, many years ago that he did, Stop Dragging My Heart Around.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
There was an influence there, no doubt about that. And so, you know, whenever you have these guys that pass away like that, it's just, you know, a good time to reflect and, you know, you can talk about what happened during his career. And,
yeah. Now, here's the thing. So, Dina, this is like the, I think this is the late night news team, right? Where you guys are out there, you're pounding the pavement. You know, you came up, you found out that Paulina Poretskova, his estranged, let's just go with it, that's what it was, wife, had found his unresponsive Rick Ocasek-ness during that time. And we had mentioned, and we were, okay, it seems odd that he's 75 years old. Not that it was odd, but it just seemed, hey, we didn't know. And time passes, and that's what happens. And I guess, and Tom, through his investigation, that we're running here, he has found that there's the actual age of Rick Ocasek is in dispute, where I guess where the police had him at 75, public records have him at maybe 70. That's a pretty big gap.
Mm-hmm. Right? That's coming to us from NPR, and that was updated at about 10:52 p.m. Eastern time. So, yeah.
Younger than I thought. Yeah. How about that?
Do we have a breaking news sounder at some point? And this is throughout the course of, you know, of time. You know, we were going to be here for a few hours, and so there may be some new details that come through. And anybody who has any knowledge of the case, 312-981-7200 as well. One of the things that we do know is the music, you know. And, Dino, you're right there, too, as far as kind of getting in. And they had great songs. You know, they had great songs. Candy O was great. That next album was really great. But they really did benefit and rode that wave of the videos. You know, when MTV, for the listeners that may be a little bit younger, because I don't know, does anyone watch MTV anymore? I don't even know where to find it.
I watch it for Doma T. I watch it for Doma T Pongo.
Okay, right.
Some people watch it for
if you don't have a friend and former colleague that is on it, or maybe one of your children is participating in the programs, maybe you haven't seen it, but there was a time
when it was music.
When it was the biggest thing. And for your favorite songs to have a video attached to it was just a whole kind of mind-blowing extra way to enjoy things. And it was big. And so the bands that happened to be able to capitalize on that, not only on the creation of innovative ways to kind of showcase music on the video side, but also just right place, right time. You know, you happen to come out with an album and you happen to do some stuff, and they were right there. You know, they
took advantage of that. They were, you know, from what I remember when I saw them perform, I don't remember them being a dynamic band. It was pretty much stand up and play, and it wasn't like there was a big, you know, light show or anything around them.
No laser light show, no smoke machine.
Not that I can
dancing
recall.
Dancing girls. Polina Poretskova was in one of the videos, so we'll get back to that as details break. So right now it is 1:30, and we're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back. We're going to send it to news. It's Dane here on 720 WGN. Who's going to tell you things? 720 WGN, Hyatt Tom Chicago, the what used to be the Allstate Skyline Studio. Now it's just the Skyline Studio. It's Dane here. Shotgun with us is Dino Tiberi. We mentioned it, the physical embodiment of the spirit, the enthusiasm of the one and only Harry Carey.
Don't believe that for a minute.
You believe it. You believe it. And then, of course, the genetic link to the Nick DiGilio show as well on the line with us. And you heard a little bit. We could do, remember that show called Name That Tune, Dino?
Yeah, that's right.
Like Robert... Name That Tune in one note. And they gave you a little bit of background on
it. Wasn't it like Robert Kennedy? I think he was the host of the show.
Maybe, but they'd say like, is this a song from Burt Bacharach?
I can name that in two notes.
Two notes. It was like, bing. It was, and they weren't even real notes from the song. It was like a piano that some guy was like, bing. You know, that's what it is. So it was tough. But hey, Blake Stubbs is on with us. And of course, you know him residing in his home theater, Palace Command Center in the recognized Hollywood of the Midwest, Peoria, Illinois. The one and only Blockbuster, Blake Stubbs. Now, Blake, welcome to the show, number one. Number one. And then number two. You heard the intro music, the bumper that Tom Hush had played, which is also part of a famous movie soundtrack. Do you need to hear it again, or is it the kind of thing, could you... Wait, no, let's do this for Blake, and also for the listeners that may have been getting their coffee or, you know, tidying up or whatever they're doing, or maybe taking a left on Lower Wacker. So, Tom, now here's the music. Blake, are you ready? Tom, the clip. Who's gonna tell you things aren't so... All right. And the question is to Blockbuster Blake Stubbs, although his expertise is all things cinematic, but I don't know. Soundtracks has never been something we've tested him on. But Blake, your thoughts?
Honestly, the last time I heard that song in a big film was in Transformers when Shia LaBeouf's character first met Bumblebee. It was one of the songs because Bumblebee's voice box was busted, so he used the radio to communicate. And he was actually kind of trolling Shia LaBeouf's character into talking to, I believe, Megan Fox's character at the time. Off the top of my head, that's the last time I heard that in a big film. But to me, you know, Living in Stereo is always going to be immortalized by Fast Times at Ridgemont High, which is another Cars song that I knew. So I, off the top of my head, maybe I'm wrong, but that was the last one I remember hearing it in.
Was it in Cars?
No, but here, think about this. And for the listeners, too, is like Blake's like, well, it's been in five different movies. The most recent one was this one. And so, so excellent work, Blake, and of course, right and correct at all times. So the kind of movies that are out there now, you know, I think they can tell a story. They can shape a perception. Mm-hmm. And maybe they can change a perception and form a little bit of backstory on the people that could be involved in, whether it's historical events or maybe vocations that have not necessarily been thought of in the highest of esteem. And so J-Lo is taking a stab at this. Your thoughts on, so the movie Hustler, and for the listeners out there, it's Hustlers is out there. It's J-Lo. It's gotten a lot of support. I talked with Dean Richards last week about it. He seemed to think it was, you know, maybe not Oscar worthy, but that's sort of the buzz.
I would argue that this is one of the most entertaining films I've seen this year. It is very enjoyable from the standpoint of, it's driven by a great cast. Jennifer Lopez, of course, is the biggest name attached, but Constance Wu is another. She gives an outstanding performance in this. There's some good supporting work from the likes of Julia Stiles, Lily Reinhart, and I would also give Kiki Palmer a big shout. This is a movie that's led by women. It's written and directed by a woman. It's got a great sense of humor about it, but there's also something that really kicks in about halfway through the movie when you start to realize that you really care about the characters on screen. And by the end of the movie, it has left you with something that it had to say. At the same time, I think the visual style of the movie really works. I think it helps forward the film along. Now, look, the trailer, the marketing for this movie really got big on sex appeal. Because these women are all exotic dancers who then sort of turn to hustling to take home extra cash. You actually find out that by about the halfway point of the movie, when I said that emotional, you know, kick starts to turn for the audiences, audience members, that really what it is they don't even do that anymore. What they're doing is downright illegal. There's a big moral conundrum, but all of these people, all these women have reasons for doing what it is that they do, and so you're left with sort of a quandary as an audience member. So ignore whatever the trailers say other than the fact that it looks cool, it looks sexy, it looks like it's going to be a little bit funny. The movie is very funny. I did see it sort of in an empty screening. I actually just saw it earlier, yesterday evening. But at the same time, trust me, I was laughing. It didn't matter if I was one of the only people in there.
Blake, when we previewed, Blake, that you were going to be coming on talking about this, you know, obviously a dedication to the show and the fans and the listeners, and then we were saying that there was a guy, you know, an out of breath guy grabs it, give me a ticket for Hustler, you know, and right, you know, and a large popcorn and a Diet Coke, and then got in there and did it. That was kind of funny, right? Because, you know, the impetus to go ahead and get a chance to see it. Now, this for the listeners too, on the perspective side, is we found out that Blake knows a little bit about soundtracks, but when it comes to, I think, a perspective on the vocation featured and highlighted in the movie, is although Peoria is a recognized Hollywood of the Midwest, it is also the home of Big Al's, right?
Yes, Big Al. Yes, one of the, I guess you could call it a Peoria institution. It is one of the, used to be a fixture in the hardcore downtown, like the real, what you would call downtown of Peoria. It made a ton of money, the organization did, and then built a massive facility just across the street from the Civic Center in downtown Peoria. So, and I will admit, I have been there. Actually, I was there once with the Peoria police. Doing a ride along, very interesting evening.
When we get taken away by the police, it is a ride along. You are riding along with them wherever they'd like to take you.
Yeah, I did find the experience interesting only in that when I arrived with the officer I was riding along with, they made me check the camera, but not the Kevlar vest I was wearing. So that was an interesting experience, to say the least. But. Yeah, that I couldn't take the camera in, but they didn't care if I had on a Kevlar vest. And that was sort of you ever do a ride-along out there, you will likely have to wear a Kevlar vest. Well, it's just sort of like policy.
Safety first, unless, of course, you're on with the Steven Seagal one, where all he's doing is pulling people over for taillights that are out in the middle of rural Georgia or wherever he's a... He's at a, like, what is he, a deputy sheriff or something?
Deputy sheriff.
Enough about that. One of the things that people keep texting in about is, and we had talked earlier about Rick Ocasek and the cars and the age and him passing in that, and Tom had divulged that J-Lo is turning 50, and people are curious because there's a certain, I guess, part of someone's life where they may feel more comfortable physically being a stripper, and once you get towards 50, you think that career could be, the opportunities could be a little less for you. So your thoughts on that? We know J-Lo's a great performer, we know she's a great dancer. Does she pull off the stripper thing, or are you thinking to yourself, come on,
you're going to walk into this movie and maybe not know it, but the timeline of the film takes place from about 2007 up until 2015. And J-Lo's character is basically the queen bee of the club when you meet her. And so her performance, it's pretty knockout. I'm not going to, you know, say anything other than if you saw her recently, I believe there have been a few performances she's done on television, like at the VMAs or something, and she just absolutely kills it. And that is J-Lo. She is an absolute superstar, not just as an actress when she really turns it on and goes all in, but also just as a dancer, singer, the whole deal. In this film, you get to see J-Lo. It doesn't matter how old she is. She doesn't look it. She's one of those ageless queens, I guess I'd call her, of Broadway, or of of Hollywood. Sadly, she's never really done Broadway, as far as I know. But that's one of those things where the live performer in her, they let her shine early. But then, from then on, you pretty much get actress J-Lo. And I think that that's something that audiences are really clicking with. I mean, that's, for me, that was one of the biggest, most impressive parts of the film, was that, yes, the film has to establish who these women are, what these women do, how they get by, why life is hard, and why they're willing to do whatever it takes, and the reasons that they have to feel that way, those motivations. And from there, yeah, I mean, aside from a knockout performance in the dancing element, which I imagine will go down as one of the sexiest things on film this year. But at the same time, then once you start to get to know that character, you see that she's larger than that by a large margin. So, and the other thing is, there's cool cameos in this. That Cardi B is in this movie, Lizzo is in this movie. Like, I was kind of falling in love with all these different people that I was recognizing. Frank Whaley is an actor that I immensely enjoy, and he has a small part in the film. That he's the type of guy you don't feel sorry for, but gives 100%. And I'm just like, what an awesome casting choice to have Frank Whaley in this movie. So I think that this is one of those movies that, for me, this year is going to be a fire on all cylinders type of movie that I was like, wow, I didn't expect it to be this good.
Yeah.
I'm going to be honest with you. Like, I expected to enjoy it. All of the early reactions I was hearing about the film were very positive. But then I thought, all right, cool. I'm hoping I get a little more than the trailers were putting out there, and that it definitely delivered in that regard.
And Tom's got a question for you.
Yeah, as a scholar of Jennifer Lopez movies such as Geely and Ice Age Continental Drift, I wanted to know, where is this rank in terms of her performances?
Or
is
Anaconda, right?
Yeah, is this better? I was going to say, is this better or worse than Anaconda? Because I think Anaconda is true neutral for her. It's not terrible, but it's not great either. But I watch Anaconda. But so is this... Is this above Anaconda?
I got to be honest, it is definitely above Anaconda. If you want to get into the upper echelon of J-Lo performances, for me, Out of Sight and Selena are probably at the upper in the upper deck. This ranks up there with those. I've been reading that some say this is like a really career best performance for her. For me, Selena is probably always going to be at the top of the list. But this movie, I think, taps into that magnetism she had in that film. And really, when you get to the final scene of Hustlers, you're going to see why J-Lo is a star. And if you weren't convinced, like, you know, by the beginning of the third act of this film, you'll see it in the very end. I think that it's a very layered performance. I think that the film, because sometimes you get actors who will perform so well, but the film that they're in, the overall end product, the total package doesn't, measure up to the performance. This is a film that's both very well done, but also her performance, along with Constance Wu, their chemistry, I think, is quite good. It's on the higher end of the quality of her performance.
Well, you mentioned it, Blake, too, the star power that J-Lo has. You never know where it's going to go. You mentioned having done some Broadway work, but you've got the ability to add in some song numbers. You've got the dance numbers already, and you never know. You could see, Hustlers on Broadway or Hustlers on Ice even, right? Or even maybe...
Yeah, Hustlers on Ice, yeah.
Maybe some merchandising with some action
I think
figures.
Larry Flint already did that at least one time.
Yes.
All right, so as we...
Yeah, that's right, I did.
As we contemplate the action figures and the toy line and lunchboxes for kids dedicated to the Hustlers franchise, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to have more with Blake as he breaks down additional movies. We may talk about the John Wick traveling exhibit that is out there in the universe now. So keep it here, 720 WGN. WGN, high atop Chicago in the Skyline Studio. It is Dane in for Nick DiGilio until 5 a.m. Dino Tiberi to my right, Tom Hush in the booth, and on the line with us, the man who has his pulse on the cinematic world in a way like no other, and sharing his thoughts on movie classics, movie history, movie soundtracks, maybe action figures and marketing.
He's got it all. He knows it all.
That's exactly right. The one and only Blockbuster Blake Stubbs, welcome back.
Thank you, as always, gentlemen. This is fun. I miss having the band together. You know what I'm saying? Usually it's the three of us just rapping about movies. If Tom's there, it's the added extra ingredient. We don't do this enough. I'm just going to throw that out there.
Well, we do it whenever we can. Because we all enjoy it and the public demands it, right? And so the public is out there demanding an additional Rambo movie. And when we talk about actors that aren't necessarily past their prime, but completely beyond, like, almost any human being's prime, right? When you look at the averages and life expectancies, and now to have a Rambo movie out there. But Sylvester Stallone has surprised us. He is every bit himself at all times, unstoppable, right? And here he is. You got another Rambo movie. I know you're looking forward to it because the first one was a classic. The second one was also classic. And then now this one.
Yeah, so Rambo Last Blood, or as some I think are calling him on the social media sphere, Home Stallone, looks like it's going to end up being Rambo versus a drug cartel, and he turns the farm that he lives on into a booby trap filled combat zone. So
that's a spoiler
it's the easiest
alert.
Premise. It's such a sucker move to get me to go to the theater, if I'm being quite honest with you, because I think you guys know I love action movies. Now, I don't have to, like, you know, think they're the greatest thing ever when I see them. I just like watching them. I think they're fun experiences to see in a theater. And in this case, sometimes with Stallone, I think it's known that occasionally when he is, like, in the director's chair or really has creative control over things, it can be hit and miss. But occasionally when it's somebody else that's in charge and he just plays his part and does what he's supposed to do, magic can happen. And in this case, the last trailer they released for this movie kind of turned me around on the idea of it. It looks to be a visceral, violent Rambo movie that I think... Stallone is quite aware that our action heroes aren't going to be like they used to be. And this might be a final swan song, although I think we all thought we'd had the final swan song for the final, you know, play for Rambo in Rambo, where it was one of the most violent movies I've seen in recent memory. But this movie looks interesting. I'm hoping that it's at least entertaining. And if any indicators of the most recent Stallone work is, and I'm really pointing at, like, Creed, there will be, and Creed 2, there will be some emotional pull. But, look, if it doesn't have that, it's a Rambo movie. And as long as it sticks to the Rambo checklist, I think I will be an entertained audience member. But I will go on record as saying I think Rambo First Blood is an excellent film. Okay. I enjoy it very much. So there you go.
Okay, so when it comes to Rambo, there's only one human being that can play that role. It is Sylvester Stallone. When it comes to the Joker, almost anyone can play it, whether it's Sid Caesar or Heath Ledger or anybody. And I think the public seems to be open, inviting, kind of welcoming to anybody's kind of take as people riff on their version of the Joker. And here it is again. It's Joaquin Phoenix, right? And it seems like, as opposed to sort of the comic book style of I'm crazy and I'm wearing makeup, you know, or whatever. And we've had some great actors. Really, I think if you took one role, yeah, and you could put it out there where people have kind of reprised that role, the Joker probably has the team photo of the best amount of acting talent, right? I mean, you look at some of the great ones who've played it.
Yeah.
So where do you put this one? Is there anything left to do as the Joker?
Well, so that's the interesting thing. I mean, this particular film, which is directed by Todd Phillips, and I believe Scorsese is on the production team for this, or a producer in some sort, because this movie is clearly borrowing a lot of the vibe from, like, Taxi Driver, The King of Comedy. I think Scorsese influences go without saying, if you just watch the first couple trailers. But this movie won the Golden Lion at the Venice Film Festival. There's nothing but buzz about it. I think if you start reading a little deeper into the reviews, it's not a perfect film, but visual style teamed with an outstanding performance by Joaquin Phoenix. It's fresh might not be the word take, but a take that audiences are going to enjoy, as I think... maybe the more accurate description. But as far as where can they go from here, I mean, honestly, I think we're all curious of where DC is going, the DC universe is actually going to end up going film-wise, because they've tried to make hard commitments to what they were doing with Zack Snyder, sort of at the helm with Man of Steel moving forward, but a lot of change-ups have occurred there. So I don't really have a true answer for you other than I think this film, with its positive critical reaction and anticipated release on October 4th,
it sounds like Kung Fu
could
Grip.
Set the tone. Yeah, this could set tone. I'm eager to see where this goes. Now, another thing to note, and Tom Hush probably has more details about this than I do, but I believe Joker will be playing in 70mm at the Music Box in Chicago.
Wow.
So if you have a chance, go see that, because I'm planning on making a trip up for it.
Yeah,
so.
That is correct. They will be playing it in 70mm at the Music Box, I think starting immediately with its theatrical release on the 4th, just as they did with Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Well, that's a point. That's yes. Appointment viewing. Well, we're going to have to get together for that. Now, your thoughts in here, and a spoiler alert, you're having Scorsese involved with it. Is there going to be, is the Joker part of an organized crime ring? Of course, he is organized, right? And he's a criminal. Or is there going to be, is he leading a drug cartel? I mean, how does the Scorsese put his kind of stamp on the Joker franchise?
I'm curious to see, strictly because, well, Robert De Niro is going to be a part of this film. The if you've seen Taxi Driver, you know that this first trailer they released kind of puts Joker, or this iteration of the Joker, in the Travis Bickle type role, except he's going to go on a different sort of journey. And I think that that's a lot of what the draw is. Plus, there's the visual style with those really dark urban colors that, even though the movie's taking place in daytime from what a lot of the trailer is displaying, which I think is a bit different than we're used to seeing with a Joker character. Usually he's a rival to the Dark Knight. This will predate Batman. I don't know enough, and I'm trying to actually avoid having anything spoiled for this one, because I think I'm seeing this performance from Phoenix being a big talked about thing. Now, it already is after Venice Film Festival, but I think audiences are going to either love or hate this. Now, me, I'll probably love it because I'm a big Joaquin Phoenix fan. But I think. Just those first two trailers, it was screaming Scorsese in my face. And then also, you know, coming up to, you got things like Jojo Rabbit and all this other stuff. I mean, we're heading into a very nice, I think, batch of films coming out in the next few months, gearing up for Oscar season. So wow. Joker, I think, is at the forefront of that right now, though, as far as intrigue for audience members goes. Well, and by the way, if you can see something in 70... you definitely should. So make arrangements to see it at Music Box if possible.
We'll have some links for that last thing. And I know when Ad Astra comes out, we're going to be talking about that at length. So if with the couple minutes that we've got, and we may see this for J-Lo, and maybe there'll be a big trailer that says Hustlers on it, right? With an interactive display and sort of museum quality exhibit for fans to get in there and enjoy, maybe polls or whatever would be in there that people can enjoy. John Wick has decided to do that. I saw this on social media. I'm like, what a crazy thing to do, to pull this thing out. They've got the car. They've got the motorcycle. They've got a bunch of different accoutrements and costumes from the show. My brother-in-law got a chance to go. I guess it was a couple-hour wait to get. I mean, so word was out on this one, and people were enjoying it, and it coincided kind of with the release of the DVD.
Yeah, so this traveling exhibit thing, I think that this is not necessarily something I knew was coming until it was already here, to say the least. But what a cool little experience. I mean, you know, the John Wick universe is a very visually intensive universe. I've said this before, and I think, Dane, when we last talked, I kind of reviewed John Wick Chapter 3 with you, and I was talking about how, you know, Chad Stahelski, who is formerly Keanu Reeves' stunt double, is the director on these films. And the way he moves the camera really helps flow action in a great way, I think, but also makes it very engaging. So when you take, like, these muscle cars and these cool suits and, you know, the motorcycles and all this other stuff, the, as you said, accoutrement, and you can put it there and make it tangible for audience members, I think it takes something that, you know, John Wick, as far as franchises go, is immensely successful. But let's be honest, it's not Marvel Cinematic Universe huge. It's niche, but it's grown immensely over its three films. And I think that providing something like that, making it a bit more interactive without, you know, bringing the violence right to people, obviously, is keeping it, you know, a movie-going experience. It keeps it very interesting and engaging and something people can interact with. And,
yeah.
Heck, I think that's fantastic.
Until we find a way to do that and have people, I guess, accept it, or maybe an appropriate waiver for them, then maybe the John Wick exhibit would have where you can get shot, stabbed, or bit by a dog, or whatever way that you want to kind of emulate your favorite scene. So, Blake, before we let you go, give out that social media so that people can continue the conversation with you on this and so many different topics when it comes to movies.
Yeah, best way to reach me is on Twitter. You can find me at Blake Stubbs. That's B-L-A-K-E-S-T-U-B-B-S.
best in the business. Thanks, Blake. Appreciate you jumping on short notice, and get some sleep. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, guys. Always a pleasure.
See you, Blake.
All right. We coming up the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn in the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. Quick break. We'll come back. Send it to news. Staying here on 720 WGN. Right? 720 WGN. It is Dane here with you in the Skyline Studio High atop Chicago. To my right, riding shotgun with us is the one and only Dino Tiberi. In the booth, Tom Hush spinning the hits and keeping us tied into some of the current events along with the songs. And Dino, you were really going into a lot of the intricacies of the performance element of the Cars, which is really kind of stand there and strum.
Stand there and play. That's exactly what any performance I saw them do. There was no theatrics. It was just playing.
No high kicks. No laser light show.
Play.
No smoke machine. And after, you know, I think that the fans felt like they'd enjoyed some quality music and no need to riot. So when you are thinking of naming your fest, you know, especially for all the reasons, number one, to generate excitement from the fan base, to I think project the level of kind of out of control excitement that is going to be happening on stage regardless of the act that is up there, and then also too, as you're going to sit down and meet with communities large and small in order to get those permits necessary in order to be able to think you want to call it Riot Fest, right? Or maybe explosive like burning down of the town fest. But Tom, right, you were there. Now, Riot Fest is one of those places when we think about bands that are kind of great and remembered and loved and revered, and they always have this sort of kind of cool blend of bands that you love and have this great kind of presence in the past and the present, and a lot of up-and-coming bands as well. There's usually a great mix.
Yeah, they did a very good job. I think it's to date, is probably the most consistently good lineup of any festival in Chicago. Lollapalooza has taken a total nosedive. Pitchfork varies from year to year, and then the rest of the festivals usually wind up somewhere in between, and this is not counting any of the street festivals that have live acts that are usually quite good, actually. But in terms of the major festivals in Chicago over the summer and then getting into early fall, Riot Fest is the best, no contest.
Naming wise, do you feel like the name... obviously it's an established name now, and so it's marketed, and it's one of the things that they're tied into, but it just seems like it would be, especially because, you know, you always talk about, okay, whatever kind of, you know, destruction happens just through the process of having a big festival, you know, and the cleanup that's necessary, just calling it Riot Fest seems to invite problems.
Well, I mean,
like, if you're not rioting, maybe you're not enjoying it to the level you should be.
It's a lot calmer than you would think.
But there, Calm Fest probably would be.
No, it doesn't sell tickets, man.
Tickets, yeah.
No, it's mainly a nod to the types of bands that they're booking. Now this is actually the first time I ever went to Riot Fest. I've never been to Riot Fest before. First time I ever went.
Okay.
But I was always in awe of their lineup.
Yeah, the lineup is always great.
How many have they had so far?
This is the 15th year. This was their 15th anniversary.
15 years.
15,
so
riots.
15 years. Started out as not even an outdoor festival. It was just kind of like various venues around Chicago.
Somebody's backyard. All right, let's go.
Well, you'd be surprised. You know, you laugh, but there's a lot of these things that have grown to be huge. You know, sometimes they do start, you know, with kind of very basic beginnings, you know, where it was very small, and then people got together, let's do more of this, and then it grows from there.
Yeah, and it was at places like Liars Club and many of the smaller venues around Chicago that catered to more punk, more hardcore sort of audience, and that's still basically their roots. Like, when you go, it's all dudes and you know, and chicks too, they're there, but it's a lot of people in denim battle jackets, okay. Like, you know, with patches all over them. I mean, you see me, I'm wearing my Slayer hat
you
right now.
You are wearing your Slayer hat.
Yeah, it's a lot of people who kind of look the part, but also it's pretty varied. It's pretty diverse, and so are the acts, honestly. You get everything from your Slayers to the Flaming Lips were there, Wu-Tang Clan was there. It was pretty insane. I couldn't believe how good all the acts were.
Now, is part of, and this sort of the greater than some of the parts collective of the Chicago music scene and the festivals that are here, as you get a chance to talk to some of those artists, is part of the reason that maybe the strength of a Riot Fest and the in the bands and the lineup is that Chicago has just really made a name for itself as kind of a great place to go and play great audiences and able to sustain a lot of these really big festivals.
Yeah, there's always people who will come to a festival in Chicago, especially you put it during the summer, like the few warm months that we actually have where the weather is relatively nice. There's nowhere better, honestly. I mean, maybe you want to go out to the middle of the desert and see Coachella. I don't want to do that. That sounds terrible. It's going to be hot and no water.
He went Charles Barkley on us.
Yeah,
it's terrible. They caught a break this weekend, too. The weather was spectacular.
Oh, my God. I was in heaven. It was great. I couldn't believe how good the weather was. I will say on Friday, the only complaint I had, I went Friday and Saturday. I did not go yesterday because I'm coming in here. But the Friday sound was really bad for some reason, and there were issues with volume. I know I talked to a ton of people that could not hear a lot of the acts, like the Violent Femmes. Great band. Love the Violent Femmes, straight out of Milwaukee. You could barely hear what they were playing, and I wasn't up front. I was back near like the sound stage where they had all that stuff going on. And usually at an outdoor festival, I find if you can get to the sound stage, you're probably going to get pretty good sound. And you're not going to get thrown into the mosh pit, which is, I'm 26 and I'm too old for that. Or almost 26 and I'm too old for that. But, I was surprised at how bad the sound was. It was in and out. I think somewhere in the middle of the Violent Femmes set, they figured out, man, we just got to crank it and hopefully push past some of the wind that was going on. But I was a little disappointed throughout the first half of the festival.
So they got a blister in the sun, didn't just kick out for the people to hear?
Unfortunately not. By the time they got to that song, and it was crazy. They had this whole horn section going on. They had like a massive like bass sax taller than the guy that was actually playing it. And they went for it. They really went all out. But I would say in the audience, most people couldn't hear it.
Yeah, on the experience side of it, you mentioned the mosh pit. And, of course, you know, you've got to be careful. Right? Safety first, and don't put yourself in positions that maybe you're not comfortable with or you don't have the, you know, maybe it's just not a safe situation in certain areas. But if you can kind of manage it, you mentioned Lollapalooza taking a nosedive. We talked with Mike Heidemann, who had been there for the days. And although there was great music and certainly a lot of great stories to talk, a lot of the headlines were all the other stuff, you know, whether it was, you
people
know,
jumping over the fences.
Yeah, people, you know, rushing the gates, people like over serving themselves, you know, hospital visits, you know, and a lot of the things that are on the negative side of a big crowd and a lot of music. So your thoughts on that? Was it basically everybody kind of knows the drill, got there, had the kind of fun that they want to have with it? Or was there issues, you know, that other than just the sound, you know, with the crowd?
Well, I mean, with any sort of festival where, you know, alcohol is being served and there's, you know, a lot of young people there who maybe don't know how to handle themselves in that sort of situation and people possibly drinking underage, you're going to get a few people that are going to overserve themselves. They're going to get too, as they say in Wayne's World, partied out. They're going to party out and they're going to pass out on some hill. But I would say for the most part, the crowd was pretty good, pretty respectful. And even with a group of people where you would expect there to be, there's some slam dancing, there were some mosh pits, but everybody was pretty good about personal space and getting people that didn't want to be in that away from it. So they could just enjoy the concert however they wanted. Didn't really notice a lot of like binge drinking or people bringing flasks or anything like that, although I'm sure they were there. Everybody just seemed really cool about it. They really don't tolerate a lot of BS. And when it comes to Lollapalooza, if you ask me, I'll be the first one to say it. It's too big for its own good. Cut that Thursday day. You don't need 4 days.
Right.
One.
Yeah.
And you need to be much more vigilant about what people are bringing in. You know, I'm not trying to ruin anybody's good time, but when you've got 15-year-olds just slamming bottles of vodka right in front of you and getting like so sick and that they have to be hospitalized, no one's having a good time. That's not good to be that person, and it's not good to be around that. It's really kind of disturbing.
Yeah, okay, wow. So you have that. I think the popularity of some of the festivals and all the ones, if you collect them, have led to more things happening in Chicago. We've talked about the fact that it's been sort of this kind of epicenter, this mecca, a venue that has kind of had a resurgence this year, in a venue that I spent a lot of time at. over the years is Alpine Valley. And so I would like to hear from the listeners too. 312-981-7200. What is your favorite festival? And for whatever reason, whether it's kind of band lineups that they have, whether it's the crowd that it brings, whether it's kind of the fun or some of those elements that are built into it, not only here and then on the venue side, where are some great places to see things? And, you know, Tom, you brought up some of these great sort of bar clubs, you know, that have been, you know, great hosts for a lot of very memorable shows. And then you've got some of the bigger ones, whether it's down in Tinley Park, you know, one of those kind of barns, you know, outdoor kind of festival situations, or Alpine Valley, which is, you know, it's got that whole acoustically perfect, you know, roof with it, and it's huge, can hold about 40,000 people. 312-981-7200. It'd be interesting to hear, as we get through some of these festivals, what are some of your favorite places that you've seen bands or experienced music? And we'll share those as well. And then, of course, the Bears, when we come back from the break, Dino, you know, one of the songs that they, you know, hit songs from last year where the kicker screwed up the game. And this did not happen, right?
They're playing
a new tune, and we'll talk about it when we come back. It's Dane here on 720 WGN. WGN. It is Dane here with you until 5 a.m. in for Nick DiGilio, the perfectly fine but a little under the weather Nick DiGilio. He'll be with you and Tom again tomorrow. Dino Tiberi to my right, Tom Hush, the stabilizing influence and music aficionado here with us, spinning the hits as well. And when it comes to hits and the Bears, the hits were maybe the double doink, you know, which were, you know, kind of things where the Bears had a great season last year, and on the people thought they would have had a chance to go even further into the playoffs, and they would have if it wasn't for the kicker. And it's one of those positions that it's essential. A lot of times people don't give it much thought, right? But if it's not working, it can really be a glaring problem. And I don't know how I feel about it, because this was the luckiest win. Also, the unluckiest almost loss, right?
Yeah. Ever.
It went both ways.
It was
ways.
A crazy ending to that game. I mean, the way it all broke down and the struggles that the Bears had all afternoon with on the offensive side. And then they did get the lead. They scored a touchdown to take the lead. The Broncos came back and scored late in the game with less than a minute left to tie it.
Yeah, it was like 30 seconds left.
Actually, they didn't even tie it. Vic Fangio, the former defensive coordinator for the Bears, decided he was going to go for two. Well, the problem was when they went to run the play, they committed a penalty. And it got moved back, so then he went to kick the ball.
Because he was too far back.
Right, so they decided to kick the extra point instead.
They missed it.
And the kicker missed the extra point, but the Bears were offsides. So now the ball got moved back to the original spot.
This is crazy.
You couldn't write this up the way it went. So then they decided, and Denver was like, well, what the heck, let's just go for two and get the win. So they did.
If they don't make it,
they lose. Right, so they get it, they go ahead, but they leave 37 seconds left on the clock, and the Bears get the ball back. There's a penalty on a questionable, according to...
Still, 30 seconds left. You know, this isn't, you know, Tom Brady or Aaron Rodgers right. back there. Wait, I mean, like, Joe Flacco's good, but like, it's not as though... I still think that a lot of Bear fans, and you can speak to that side of it as you were watching it live, probably felt like, we got this. Or no, we were feeling that you didn't think that they were going to be able to come back, right?
No, that with 30 seconds 30 left seconds. Away. Based on the week before's performance by Mitch, it was tough to think, yeah, they're going to come back and go down the field and get the field goal they need. Well, as it was...
Again, the refs...
There was a couple questionable calls on hits earlier in the game against the Bears.
Yeah.
And the Bears got a break and got a roughing the passer penalty, which pushed the ball 15 yards down the field. And then they was able to make a completion, which was ruled... Initially,
and for the listeners too, like, I was busy judging Grand Cachon. I did not get to see this, so I was able to say, like, well, okay, did the Bears end up winning? And I checked it, and it looked like they won. Seemed just run of the mill. You know, the box score didn't convey
the
craziness, right? And so I saw the replay, and it was like, what? How can this even happen?
Right.
And so what I saw was they did complete that pass over the middle. I'm not sure if they had any timeouts or anything.
They had one timeout left, and they called it right when when he went down on the ground. Apparently it was called from the sideline. There was a timeout called by Matt Nagy, and next thing you know, the kicker's coming out.
A lot of times when it gets to zero like that,
Well, Denver was waving. All the defenders are waving their arms like the game was over, and they ruled that there was 1 second left on the clock. So now you bring out the beleaguered kicker. So you have 1 second left, game-winning field goal. He's already hit two. He hit one from 52 and one from 40. So that now this is the third field goal of the game for him.
When you say beleaguered,
meaning that he's been under pressure since the beginning of
unnatural pressure.
Yeah, sure. I mean, everybody's like, you know, because the kicker apparently, you know, that's. He's the lifeblood of the team at this point, apparently.
Yeah,
so
Cody Parkey did like yeah. He was a tough act to follow.
Exactly. So now he's under pressure. He gets out on the field, 53
so
yards.
Much pressure.
I mean, come on, the whole city's like, you got to make this kick, dude. This is all you're out there for.
Sucks.
So yeah, and so he kicks it,
and
makes
it's at
it.
Elevation. He had never been
right.
in Denver before.
Sure. But just the fact that the game's on the line, you make it and you win and you miss it, and then we're all talking about it for another week about how they don't have a kicker and blah, blah, blah.
Even though this was, because Cody Parkey, he missed a lot of pretty easy kicks. He made a couple tough ones, right, throughout the course of the season.
Sure.
But he missed a lot of ones he should have made.
Four of them off the goalpost in one game? I mean, how does that happen?
But, so to have it be like, okay, you're going to be, game on the line, no time on the clock, 53 yards, and if you miss it, well, it's because you're terrible. It's a lot of pressure.
Yeah, it's a lot of pressure, and it's a team game. I mean, the fact that everybody's loading it up on a kicker, it's just not really.
How did they get down there and score?
Well, that's the whole thing. It's like, they have to get in a position to do that. So Mitch didn't do a whole lot during the game statistics-wise. The defense bent but didn't break. And, they gutted out a win that it was an improbable victory in the end. And it was really, who at the end of it, when they made the field goal, it was just amazing the fact that, they walked out of there surviving and coming back 1-1 instead of down 0-2. Because you go down 0-2, the Packers won against Minnesota. Now they're looking up two games in the standings with one in hand because, the head-to-head. That's you're two games into the season, you're already behind the eight ball because that's the way it was playing. So I was just it was a weird game. Just weird. I don't think I've ever seen an ending like that.
A lot of extra pressure on the kicker, and a lot of it wasn't necessarily his fault. You mentioned the other game, so much was going into the hype for that season kickoff, not only for the season for the Bears or the Packers, but for the NFL, for the 100th season, right?
Right.
It was all starting right here.
Sure.
And I think people, in Bears Nation felt comfortable saying minimum 8 Pete. There were so many, all the commercials,
all the hype that was built up for, that whole week leading to it. And even when the game came out on the schedule, it was like, oh, the Packers first week, Monday, Thursday night football.
It'd be nice to kick them around a little while as we get our Super Bowl run going.
That's right. We'll be 1-0. That'll be an easy win. Yeah, right. So,
but to go 0-2, and even for the Broncos, see, this is what you hate to see, is it's one thing when you get a team that's like, because every team understands, unless you're the 72 Dolphins, you're going to lose a game here and there. And so sometimes you could say, like, okay, well, maybe we want it more, or maybe our team will. You look at this, the first time that the Broncos have gone 0-2 since, like, 1999, they didn't want to lose either. They're at home.
Right.
They wanted to, so this is, it's a tough deal, and if the Bears go 0-2, then this whole place is on fire.
Oh, yeah. And I'm sure there were some choice discussion made after the game between OB and Hamp and the gang.
I thought that. So, and I know that
I didn't get a chance to listen to them, and I want to listen to
I know Tom's got some audio, and I know we've got a guest coming up. We're going to talk a little bit about important things so that you don't have to go into the topsy-turvy, challenging world of being a kicker in the NFL. It's not stable, right? We're going to talk about educational funding, and we've got a cool interview that we're going to have at 2:30. But later on in the program, I know that Tom has got some audio from Hamp and OB, and it's tough. Because, you don't want to face them. I would hate to, be the team. It's one thing to say, hey, fans can go ahead. But they're, so famously and legendarily crabby. even when things were going okay, it seems like it was tough. So we're going to take a break. We're going to come back. We've got a great interview coming up. It's Dane here on 720 WGN. Seven WGN, it is Dane here. Hi, atop Chicago in the Skyline Studio until 5 a.m. And, Dino, I know that you're a guy that's out there caring and supporting and in a bunch of different ways, whether it's your favorite charity, right, or educational things, you know, with your niece and your nephew, you're trying to support them in every way that you can. And when sure. people can come through and add in the magic of technology in order to help with that, I think you're ahead of the game. On the line with us, we've got Janet Alec-Pala. She's one of the co-founders of Koha. And this is interesting. Janet, welcome to WGN.
Hi, good morning.
So, and good morning to you. Thanks for taking time out and jumping on. For our kids, we've got, on a regular basis, there's fundraisers that we do to support things. I also support a bunch of different causes, great causes, you know, a lot of well-deserving causes out there, whether it's, you know, the food pantries or the environment or people doing, I think, important work in the medical fields. And so it's always been a challenge for them to be able to kind of streamline or kind of perfect that fundraising thing. And you guys have done a great job kind of leaning towards that with Koha. Talk a little bit about what it is. So it takes a lot of the ways that we do things now with apps on our phone and brings it into the fundraising side.
Sure. So we're excited about this technology. What's really neat is we've got a really giving local business community, a lot of small businesses around the area that are always looking for a way to give back. They're always asked for donations constantly. And one of the challenges that they see out there, they're always asked, and then they never see the customer come back sometimes, whether they give a gift card or a check for a gala or a golf outing. One of the things that they always want to see is, you know, when are they going to come back and support us? So the technology that we developed helps allow that. So whenever you go into a local mom and pop shop, like a boutique or a restaurant that's local to the community, you go in there, you spend money, take a picture of the receipt, and a nice portion actually goes back to a school or nonprofit in the area.
Well, here's one of the things that I think is a little bit different about this that you can go ahead and share is that you have local businesses, small businesses, people that are active in the community and supporting issues, and so you're able to do that. There are bigger stores out there that maybe have fundraising elements or causes that they, as a corporation, support, and you can get in and do this. But this allows companies to get on board. So how does it work? So if, let's say, you've got a cause, you've got either a nonprofit that you support or you're looking to kind of help and support your local school, like, how hard is it? Is this something the business that you can sort of, I don't want to say recruit them, but educate them and get them involved, or is this something that they have to initiate?
You know, it's not hard at all. So what's great about this, a lot of the schools and the nonprofits we work with in the area suggest local businesses, or likewise, we've got local businesses that are like, you know, we want to give back, but we want to give back in a way that's easy. You know, we're always trying to chase schools and nonprofits, and this is such a fun way to do it because we're constantly promoting local business. A lot of local businesses have a hard time really getting the word out there in a way that makes sense. You know, they're spending a lot of money on advertising. Sometimes they're not getting what they want to see back. When we get to promote them on more of a like a people approach, where we're talking about the business owner being part of the school or part of the nonprofit, it really drives that message home that they really believe in the schools and the nonprofits they're giving back to, because they may be a parent in the community. They may be a business owner that had gone to the schools or had benefited from that nonprofit. So this is such a great way to give back. It's a win-win for the community, because when you go in and shop local, you're giving right back to the community, and it just works. It's just such a great, unique way. And I think when you're going to a bigger, you know, business, a bigger corporate or more global business, you're not seeing that benefit. You're only seeing that once a year. This is all year round. You get to support that business all year round. So that's what's great about this program.
Also, too, is you've got it where it's kind of a win-win for the business as well. Certainly the business can get a tax deduction or feel good about supporting things in kind of that traditional, here's for this specific event or whatever kind of, you know, campaign that they're running. But here, like, in order to support it, the people are, and correct me if I'm wrong, but so people will come in, they will buy stuff, they'll patronize that business, and then a portion of the proceeds will go back to support whichever specific cause that person designates. Is that right?
That's totally right. You know, and it's been really great to see the donations building so quickly. You know, we're seeing some of the schools in the community getting some, you know, they're building to some really nice fundraisers and checks. So we love to help supplement anything that they're already doing. You know, everyone's doing bake sales and car washes. We don't want to tell people to stop doing that, but we want to tell people, hey, there are some local businesses out there that really want to give back. So help shop them locally, and a nice portion will go back to your school. And it's just so fun to see people really supporting their local business communities, these smaller businesses that really, really want to help and give back.
Well, let the listeners know we're talking with Janet Alec Polish. She's one of the co-founders of Koha, which is a year-round fundraising app that allows you to tailor it to your needs for your, whether it's your school or your cause, and tie in businesses that can help support it in a way that also helps them. One of the things, Janet, that I saw too in one of the graphics that you had that I thought was really cool is just like on your Fitbit or any other dashboard thing where you get in there and you're able to see the sort of stats and track it, and it just feels like you're invested in sort of, it makes it fun, right? In some ways is that you've got the ability to compete with some of your other fundraising colleagues, right? So instead of just outbidding them after a number of cocktails in the live auction, which is always fun, I'm not saying people shouldn't do that.
I've done that many times, Dan. It works every time.
But here you've got a way where you can track it and you can see who's there, and you say, like, hey, I got to get over to the store and buy some more stuff because looks like Jonathan S. is pulling ahead.
Yes, you know, it's been really fun too. Like, we've gamified the fundraising experience. We've got a leaderboard on the app where you can kind of see who is supporting and shopping the community. And every time you shop, you earn points, and it's been really fun. You know, every time you shop local, you earn points. And one of the nice features on this app, even though you're giving back through the purchase, when you're gaining these points, you earn rewards from some of these local businesses. Like, say I earn 1,000 points, I can earn a free cup of coffee, free appetizer, free service, like a free oil change, I think that's on there. But let's say I don't want to redeem the rewards. Those points can be turned back into dollars to go back to the school or the nonprofit you're supporting. So, yeah, it's been really fun to see the competition between the parents and volunteers in the community.
So you shop at a local merchant in the Koha Network, you snap a photo of your receipt, support, you choose your favorite school or nonprofit, and you win not only the rewards that you can kind of turn back in, or you can kind of just enjoy that cup of coffee, along with the good feeling of helping and supporting a great cause. So when it comes to the app, is this something that's just available like on the Play Store or iTunes? Like, how do people get involved, get it going, and start working on this?
Sure, you know, go into Apple, the iPhone iStore, or Google Play, look up Koha, K-O-H-A, download the app. If you're a local business in the community and want to give back, jump on board. Likewise, if you don't see your school or nonprofit, let us know at more@koha.life, and we'll add you to the platform. It's very easy. We just want to support and give back.
This is really cool. So, I mean, before we let you go, a little bit on the background, it's great to give back by helping to create something that can help make the world and a lot of the people in it and some of those institutions and causes a better place. But how did you decide to do it? Was this out of the blue? You're like, or were you there trying to outbid someone at the
gym? Yeah. Right. Gym's at the top, but now like, I'm going to take over.
I can't do this anymore. There's got to be a better way. How did it start?
You know what? A friend of mine who is a business owner in the community, and myself, we both served on, you know, education foundations. We love giving back together. But he asked me one day, is there a good way to give back to the community? Because we're always asked, we're bombarded with donations. There has to be a better way for business owners like me to give back to the community where they're always coming back. And I come from a nonprofit background. I was the person chasing money all the time. And we put our heads together, brought in a really great technology officer, and we just put it all together. Here we are about a year and a half later using this technology and really seeing it work. So I'm really proud of what we've come, you know, from, and I love seeing business owners stepping up and saying, I want to give.
Yeah, it's really cool.
Here we are.
making something really fun, really cool, making a difference as well. Janet Alec-Pollock, co-founder of Koha, and we'll have links up at WGNRadio.com so people can not only hear this but also get information on it, get on that platform, and start utilizing it to kind of help do some fundraising, make it not only just for the specific events but year-round, and have it be a win-win for the business and for the cause as well. So, Janet, thanks so much for what you're doing. It's really cool for you to get in there and sort of make a difference in this way. So we appreciate all that, and thanks for jumping on the show tonight.
Thank you so much. Have a great day, guys.
Thanks.
All right. So there it is. Raise some dollars for your cause, Dino.
Oh, that's awesome.
It's as easy as it gets.
That's absolutely fantastic.
And even if you just want to be competitive, you don't even have to know the cause. Just say, like, oh, there's Jonathan S.
Oh, that's it.
I'm going to go support the giraffe exhibit at the, you know, or whatever, or this school. You don't even go to. You just want to, you want to win.
Yeah, I don't want Al to be the guy at the top of the list. I got to get up to the top of the list.
That's right.
That's all there is to it.
That's right. Well, it's really good stuff. So it's good to see people out there doing some great things. So we are going to take a break, and we come back. People poised to do great things, hopefully down the road in the season, is the Chicago Bears, and then people poised to talk about it and hopefully be positive and not have their heads explode, which is a serious health, a realistic health concern for Hamp and OB. So we're going to have, I think Tom's got some clips from them. We're going to talk a little more Bears when we come back. Quick break. It's Dane here on 720 WGN. WGN, it is Dane here. Hi, at Tom Chicago Skyline Studio. Dino Tiberi to my right, with us for the duration. Tom Hush, of course, as you know, part of the Nick DiGilio show, and we'll be here till 5 a.m. In for Nick, who is feeling better and better. He was just a little under the weather last night, so we're stepping in here. And so we're going to get to be the ones who get to break down the Bears action. You know, Hamp and OB, and Dino, you know, because we know these guys. These are legendary Chicago fixtures on the sports and broadcasting side. One of the things I think that ties them together, because they come from different eras, is not only their, well, let's say
their passion for the game.
There's two things right there. That's three. Now we've got three things. Passion for the game, their love for the Chicago Bears, and their general dissatisfaction with everything. Where they're usually like
the glass is definitely half empty.
Well, but the success of last season, although ending on really a very disappointing note, but still portending to success in the future.
Right.
And so the Bears did win in an exciting fashion. Instead of being, well, I don't know, maybe I'm predicting here, and I heard a little, instead of being like relieved and excited, I think they were still crabby. Yeah. So, Tom, you've got a couple clips?
That I do, and most of them have to do with complaining about Mitch Trubisky. And they've decided to give him a new nickname. Take a listen here. This is ridiculous.
Priceless.
But I'm going to tell you something, folks. We got 14 games to go, and we had a quarterback today. You people that watched the game, you saw it. You saw it right in front of you, and that's what we've got to go 14 more games
Mitch
with.
Stinkbinsky. He stinks. is horrible. I don't care. He is horrible, Ed.
Wow.
Well, it was Mitch Stinkbinsky.
Ed had called him, and I thought, I didn't want to let the cat out of the bag and spoil it, I thought he was going to Trubisky because he was missing all of his show. Because Ed had called him that before. Like, True Stinksky, that seems even like a stretch on the, like, I don't even know.
They're working on it.
It's outside of the box of clever.
He was really working that one in there.
He was. Now, do you feel, Kaz is more, I think, of a calming personality and influence. But do you think maybe he gets riled? Maybe it's sort of like mob mentality that
they're all in.
They're, you know, smashing and then he just gets swept up.
You can't get around that. When you've got two icons in the room and they voice their opinions, of course he's going to jump on that train. There's no question about that.
So did we have it? Was that the clip we have? Or
no, we got a little bit more here. Here's another one from last night's show.
I'm tired of hearing the media suck up to this kid and say, oh, it's okay. And, you know, Matt Nagy, let's be you. BS. This kid stinks. Let's find a new quarterback.
Whoa. That's all that number two picks, pretty much a throwaway at this point.
Yeah, Ryan Pace, he bet the entire farm and all the other farms he had access to in a really leveraged situation in order to get Mitch Trubisky. And I think that everybody would agree that there's the tools, right, the building blocks for a successful quarterback. I think everybody's kind of thinking that. Well, now, he started pretty slow, and I didn't get a chance to watch the game. Do you know, should the Bears have been farther ahead?
Well, I mean, part of it was the fact, both games so far, there's been some inaccuracies, there's been some drop passes, there's been just mistakes being made. The first week, it reminded me of an exhibition game with both teams because neither one of them really played together in the preseason at all. And they came out and they looked it when they came out there offensively for both teams. And today was more of the same. This was the question going into the season with Mitch was, is he going to be able to take the next step? Is he going to be able to
take
one step? I mean, to go forward instead of backward. And so far, it's been a struggle. And if they're going to run into teams that have a good defense and a good offense, and they're going to have problems, because if they have to match points with teams right now, they can't do it. They're barely making it into the teens.
Just to you hear a little bit of the audio there. You know, the Trubisky and Trubisky, and he's terrible, and he's horrible, and he's not good, and he's got personality issues and hygiene issues too. Right there, we said Stinksky. So I got to remind people though that. Didn't last year Mitch Trubisky tie or extend a Bears touchdown record for one game? Wasn't Mitch Trubisky the guy who made it to the Pro Bowl for the first time since, not Sid Luckman, Jim McMahon?
Those are the strides that they want, that we all thought he would build upon and then go forward from there. I mean, he did do those things.
I mean, he's got...
Granted, it was against a horrible defensive team in Tampa Bay last year, but still, that's six touchdowns is six touchdowns. I mean, that's a lot.
These are NFL players.
Right.
I'm guessing you're getting paid to stop him. But
I just think right now they don't have the consistency on offense. And part of it to me was the play calling. Both weeks, it's like, one drive today, nine runs in a row. How about mixing in a pass here and there just for fun?
I don't think anyone saw that coming. So they're like, hey, are they going to run it again? No, they would never do that. There they go. Just trying to mix it up, trying to be one of the thoughts, too, is that because Vic Fangio understands what they do. And I talked with Jarrett Payton last week with Bill Leff when I was in, and we were talking about the fact that they may have to just do completely different things just because he knows everything that they're going to do. Like, Tom, was there any more audio, or was that it?
We got one more little clip here just to round it all out.
Round out the anger.
This is a passing league. You've got every rule in the book going for you, and we have a quarterback again who lucky he can throw for 100 yards.
Well,
God!
Wow. That's passion.
That's OB right there, personified. That was perfect.
That mic got a little hot as the decibels reached. Like DEFCON 5.
Well, at least he wasn't slamming on the table this time. On Thursday when Nick and I played back some audio, it was just table slamming.
Now,
horrible.
Now, Tom, you have the opportunity to talk with your colleagues on the producer side here. And is there any days for an OB? Because one of the things I think about with him and Dan Hampton is that they're authentic. They're authentically, or do they come in? Is there ever a time when OB, who isn't the youngest, he's in great shape for everything and super passionate and in tune and all that. Does he ever, for me, it would be, I'd get in and be like, I don't know if I feel like being so angry, but you got to turn it on like the Hulk, right? And you've got to be excited about it. But it seems, because here they did win. Wasn't there
any silver lining in that dark cloud?
Hey, you know what? We dodged a bullet there. We're going to go back. But
you know what, though? These guys can see right through that. I mean, they won. Yeah, it was nice that they eked out a victory, but come on. This offense is putrid right now. And they're right. They're right. Their offense is bad.
And why? Okay, so I think this is where we're looking at. So when the first year for Mitch Trubisky, you had sort of a dysfunctional, offense, possibly coaching staff situation, right? So you had that.
Personnel was bad,
too. You didn't have any receivers at all.
They were pulling vendors in from the stands to go out and do an out
literally,
pattern.
Right? And so then you had you had a better running game. You had some. And so now this was a time where you have a lot of potential. The word is out. Granted, a little bit of a tougher schedule, but then they've put those pieces in place. And we're not just talking about the kicker here. They put receivers in place. And so now it's time for Mitch Trubisky. There aren't any more excuses.
No, he's got to make that next step. Otherwise, we're going to be talking about him and Cade McNown in the same sentence. I mean,
Cade McNown.
Just horrible. I mean,
Cade McNown at the time, for the listeners who don't remember, and hopefully you don't, you know, you've been Men in Black.
I hope you wipe that out of your memory bank, fans.
Wasn't he the UCLA guy that was the most NFL ready?
Awful.
But you look at him, and he just wasn't big enough or strong enough to handle that kind of stuff, and it kind of played out where Mitch, regardless of the amount of snaps he didn't take in college, had all the tools, right?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, to me, he's an athletic guy. I think he's not doing the things that he was successful with last year. He's not getting out of the pocket. They're not rolling him out. He's not running down the field. He's trying to make a play when there isn't one. There's just basic things that I'm not a football expert like, you know, our guys are that do the post game, you know, OB and Hamp. What I see is just a guy that seems to be struggling with doing basic things right now, you know, getting to a second or third receiver in his reads. He's just not getting there. And these are things that puzzle me because, you know, this is a third-year quarterback now. We're not talking about a guy who just got here.
We don't want you to be puzzled. But I think also safety first is you have to look at maybe that the Bears or maybe Mitch Trubisky could pull some things together just for the sake of maybe the health of Hamp and OB. Mike is on the line. Mike, welcome to WGN.
Hey, good morning, gentlemen. Here's a couple of points with you guys while I was listening. You know, my point is Trubisky last year, Mitch pretty much, I love OB and Hamp. You know, grew up with the Bears, the whole nine in Chicago. Love the Bears. But, you know, there comes a point in time where even he last year, the Bears pretty much went from worst to first last year. And pretty much this same kind of post-game show we were listening to in the beginning, and he shut them up. I remember part of the game, part of the post game, you would hear them going one way and then completely going the other way because he proved that he could do something. And obviously, you know how they say the league, whether it's baseball, football, any kind of sport, they catch up to you eventually. My thing is have a little objectivity. Their post game has really gotten to the point. It's like they're not. I don't know. I don't even know how to say this without being. I don't know, outsigning may be objective, but they just yell too much. To me, it just got over. They've gone overboard. It's over the top.
Yeah.
And I don't know if they do it for radio sake or whatever.
Well.
But it's honestly, and I know they're passionate, but the thing is, I'd also blame the Bears for not playing this kid throughout the preseason. He's not Tom Brady. He's not Aaron Rodgers. How do you not practice him throughout the preseason? Everybody knows he needed it.
Yeah.
It's just that's dumb on their part.
Well,
really dumb.
Well, Mike, I appreciate you listening and appreciate the input, and it's taken heart, so appreciate you weighing in today on the show.
All right, guys. Have a good one.
All right. Thanks. See, that's it. So he needs more practice, Mitch Trubisky. We'll talk a little bit more about this as soon as we get back from the news break right now at 2:57. Coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn in the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. A quick break. We'll be back to send it to news, 720 WGN. Yeah. All right. 720 WGN. It is Dane here. Skyline Studio High atop Chicago. Little Eddie Money in recognition of just, you know, everything that's going on. And we lost not only Eddie Money recently this last week and Rick Ocasek from the Cars. And it makes you think about some things. 312-981-7200. Other musicians. But here's the thing that's the positive side of it. Very few of us are going to be leaving kind of lasting legacies that people can enjoy. And some of those things...
I'll speak for yourself. I mean, come on.
Well, no, of course, Dino's like 12 disc set is out there. And in decades from now, when Dino's done doing stuff like breathing, then it'll be...
That's my legacy, just breathing.
He's still breathing. No, I mean, when you're done, you know, being alive... far into the future.
Yeah, next week. But anyway.
For all of us. Yeah. Far, 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 far. You know, you'll have that stuff left over. And these are things, too, that, you know, I think for the family and all sorts of things can generate. But, you know, like, Elvis's estate, I think, makes hundreds of millions of dollars a year, right?
Of course. And I'd stole the cash cow even to this day.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. Keep bringing it. Stop down at Graceland.
We did an interview with Dave Hammond, a good friend and colleague. He does a lot of work in Oak Park and in New City and contributes to some of the great stuff in the Tribune. And he does a lot of travel, does a lot of food, and we've worked together on a bunch of different things. He covered and attended the Tupelo Elvis Fest. and so there was...
That's where it all started, man.
He had some pictures of these Elvises, you know, the funny part was
hilarious.
Well, them on like a, you know, a Greyhound bus being taken to an area and then just kind of milling about, you know, just kind of sharing their, and none of them were in the, and I know that people are thinking right now, you know, were they in the jumpsuits? Not in these pictures. These were just like
just wearing shorts and a polo.
Pretty much.
A lot the sideburns.
Of jeans and maybe a button-down shirt, you know, but still Elvis. But to see them in a collection in the quantity of maybe 20 to 30 of them, you know, little ones, big ones, short ones, fat ones, you know, all sorts of different Elvises.
All size Elvis.
Right, but they've all got the common, like you know, they're all Elvises.
Sorry, man.
It was a great picture. It was a great picture. Well, we all hope that someday, you know, just as like the 85 Bears have, you know, some of the personalities associated with that team and become icons, not unlike Elvis, right? Where they're still, you know, out there recognizable.
They're still beloved all over the place.
With greatness. I'm wondering, are there other, in other markets, I've traveled a little bit and I'm trying to think if there's anything quite like it. The 85 Bears are recognized as possibly one of the greatest teams of all times for a bunch of different reasons. The defense, for sure, you know, some great Hall of Fame, well, Walter Payton, you know, on the offensive side, you know, but one of the greatest teams of all time. And I think part of it was because of the personalities that they had. I mean, it was a crazy collection on the coaching side. You know, you had Buddy Ryan, you had Mike Ditka. These are big personalities. And then so many of those players as well. And I think all of that has contributed to that moment in time to where they're still, you know, doing car commercials, they're still cashing in to this day.
Absolutely. And you know what? You see them, you know, they do all kinds of different things, as you said, owning businesses, you know, radio. They were doing radio shows back in the day. Some of them, you're still doing radio things now. You know, Steve McMichael, you know, he's got a play, you know, a bar, and he's got, you know, all kinds of different things. And
they run for mayor.
Yeah. And so they're still recognizable people, you know, 40, 30 years later. I mean, it's amazing, you know, they had the 1 year but it was so spectacular, and they've basically just ridden that, you know, now.
I can hear what you're saying, and I kind of can tell what you're thinking. You want to say, like, they've kind of ridden it, they've sort of, but really, I think the public is, it hasn't been them necessarily milking it. I think
they're still beloved by all of us, and that's why that still continues.
I think the Super Bowl shuffle and everything, and so this was, I felt, as the going into, you know, week one, that you almost had, we were almost ready. It wasn't too, because even like 2007, he had a team, an underwhelming team personality list, right? Yeah. From the coaching staff all the way to Rex Grossman. But you had, you know, they got to the Super Bowl. That was pretty big. But people just weren't ready to have another, you know, even if they would have, I think even if they would have won,
they wouldn't have replaced, still wouldn't have replaced right. That group.
They wouldn't have replaced the 85 Bears, where I think now people feel sort of ready to move on in their relationship. And a little bit later on in the program, we're going to have six weirdly common lies couples tell each other. So stay tuned for that. 312-981-7200. If you've got some little fibs that everybody kind of talks, we've got some fun ones here that we're going to go through. But I think now, as far as kind of moving on, I felt like the Bear fan base just was ready, right, to just embrace a new team.
Sure. There were expectations, you know, 12-4. Now it's time to take the next step. Now people were talking, some people were talking Super Bowl, you know, and that might be a little ahead of ourselves there, but.
Dito says you can go ahead and set and break records when you're playing the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. So let's look at the schedule, because I think that's part of the potential problems, right, when you want to go ahead and do this, is now you're playing better team. You had a great season. Now you've got a tougher schedule.
Now you're playing a first place schedule instead of a fourth place schedule. So the next game that the Bears have is against the Redskins next Monday, a week from today.
I'm just trying to be like, win. Right. Okay.
Or I would just say that. The following week, they play the Vikings at home.
Okay. At whose home?
In Chicago.
Okay. So if the
Soldiers Field.
If the Vikings are ready to just be terrible and have it be one of those rebuilding horrible seasons.
No, they're on their way.
Vikings are a pretty good team. Preseason
they're not bad.
They thought they were pretty, so they have the potential to be good, but they could always give up.
Yeah, I think the Bears get that one at home somehow. That's a home game win. Then they go to London to play the Raiders the following week.
Should be. I mean, it's the Raiders.
The Raiders are a better team, but I think that should still be a win.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you know, they have the bye the following week, so they're going to win that one.
That's right. You can't lose. Rest up, heal up. Hopefully, health-wise, right, they stay healthy.
Sure. And then after that, in October 20th, the Saints come to town. That's going to be a tough game.
That's going to be tough.
That's going to be a tough
one. Drew Brees still on that team?
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah, although he got injured today. Hurt his thumb.
I'm not happy about that.
He didn't have a real good game today, but he got injured. So that's. But then the 27th, Bears and the Chargers in Chicago. I think that's going to be a tough one, too. I mean, this is the thing. You play a tougher schedule. You're going to have some of these games that might have been prohibitively favoring the Bears, not so much now. After the Chargers?
Jacksonville Jaguars in there anywhere?
No. After the Chargers, then it's the Eagles in Philadelphia.
Oh.
So.
You know how they hate Santa.
Then the Bears take on the Lions in Soldier Field.
Okay. That's a win.
Yeah, that's in November 10th. Then the Bears and the Rams on Sunday Night Football the following week.
All right.
The Giants after that, so that should be a win.
Okay, we're going to get back to this schedule. We've got to take a break in order to get to some of the other things, but this is what they call in the business a cliffhanger, right? So when we come back from this break, we got a chance to talk with Greg Rempe from the Barbecue Central show, and got an opportunity to talk with him about what it is that he does, and when it comes to whether it's the competition side or some of the personalities. He's sort of the breaking news guy in the world of barbecue. So quick break. We're going to get a chance to talk with Greg Rempe. It's Dane here on 720 WGN. WGN on the road with Dane, live here in the Allstate Skyline studio, high atop Chicagoland, and excited to have in studio with us the physical embodiment of, I think, the barbecue news community. He is, I think, the Walter Cronkite of barbecue, and residing in, I think, what is recognized as the barbecue center of maybe the east end of the Midwest, Cleveland, Ohio, the one and only host of Barbecue Central show, Greg Rempe. Greg, welcome to WGN.
Dane, great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you here. It's great to have you physically here. You come into the, whether it's the cell phones or computers or homes of so many people that are barbecue fans around the country, and now to have you here, kind of do what they say in the business, the old switcheroo, right? We're going to be asking
it
you
rarely happens, to be honest. I mean, of all the years I've done the show, for me to turn around and get interviewed is, this might be the fifth time.
Well, I don't necessarily see this as an interview. I see this kind of as a conversation. There's a lot of things that I'm interested in. I know a lot of people are excited to hear. There's probably some things that you may want to be able to share a little bit about the show, or about maybe the origins of the show that aren't necessarily part of the typical Barbecue Central show format, right? You know, so let's talk a little bit about it, because here's what it is. And I'll tell this for the listeners out there that aren't necessarily familiar, and we'll have all the links up at WGNradio.com, is what Greg has done is taken, as so many people try to do in the podcast world, has taken sort of a world, a universe, a space, a wheelhouse, if you will, and kind of carve out, I think, a very important niche in it as really sort of that conduit of information, of conversations for barbecue.
I never thought it was going to evolve into where we are today. If you look back 12 years, it all started with my wife bought me a kind of a crappy grill. I cooked through the back of it in like a year and a half. We were going to go out and buy another one. It was going to be this really nice stainless steel $1,200 grill that was at Home Depot. And I just happened to have a chance conversation with my cousin, who was in Maryland at the time and was a barbecue caterer. And he said, "Have you ever thought about getting a barbecue pit?" And I said, "Glenn, I have no idea what a barbecue pit is." So we had a conversation, and ultimately he said, "I think you could get a pretty decent entry model," which ended up being a Weber Smoky Mountain, "and a pretty decent gas grill. Now you have two cooking vessels, two different methods of cooking, and you probably will save yourself some money in the long run by not buying that $1,200 or $1,300 grill that I was looking at the Home Depot at that point." So that's where it started. I got the Weber Smoky Mountain. My wife got it for me as a Father's Day gift. Didn't know how to use it. I read the directions, which anybody knows, Weber Smoky Mountains, that's the worst thing you can do is read the directions when it tells you how to fire it up. And the first rack of ribs that I made was horrifically average, and there was a distinct point in time where that was going to become a flower pot in the back. But then I found the virtualweberbullet.com, which was specifically related to that cooker, learned the minion method, and that's when I got on the track, and it just got out of hand from there.
So walking the walk on the actual food side, and then kind of figuring out, so many times, this is one of the things I think that is unique about the barbecue community, is that it is a very communal place. It is a conversational place. The people love to get together. They love to talk barbecue, and they have so much in common. Was that part of it? Is not only just kind of reaching out for advice on how to become better at what it is that you wanted to do, but was it also just like, hey, let's talk about this? I mean, barbecue people love to talk.
Certainly it was knowledge at first, because I didn't know what I was doing. It was a completely new cooking or way of cooking for me. But as I became more active on that particular message forum, I indeed realized exactly what you said. Here's a community of like-minded individuals. They like smoked meat. They're freely passing all of their expertise and knowledge and tips and tricks around. And over time, you move from that noob into, you know, kind of that medium knowledge guy, and then into the savvy veteran, and you see the new people coming on. And it's this whole circle of life of barbecue knowledge. And I got to the point where I was evidently over communicating on this message forum, and the owner of the Virtual Weber Bullet said, hey, you got to stop asking so many questions. You're costing me too much money. And I said, well, this is like a message board, so...
Was he getting charged by how many messages?
Who knows what they're doing back in 2006. So I said, you know what? I can make my own. So I made my own barbecue forum. Back then it was the BBQ4U forum. And it was on a free bulletin site. Cost me no money. And it grew. I invited some people over at first to get a little street cred on the barbecue scene, but eventually it started growing on its own and became one of the more active forums. I mean, it seems so old technology now. Like, you go somewhere, you post a question, you wait for somebody to get back to you. Now it's YouTube, or just find it anywhere. But that's how it was back then. And it grew and grew, and all of a sudden there seemed to be more of an influx of barbecue forums. So to separate myself, I had heard about podcasting maybe 6 months before and really didn't know what it was. And I decided to look into that, and that was the first separator off of all those other forums. Then more podcasts came out, and then to re-separate again, I looked into doing a live show via the internet. They call it internet radio. That was still a term that's really weird for me, internet radio. Just internet show.
Right.
And that's where we are. Live show, you know, has been 12 years now, I think. So it's great.
You think about just where that kind of medium of, whether it's media or communications or however you categorize it, has really changed and evolved to the point where I remember. So I've been, you know, working in radio for 20 plus years. And, you know, when the whole idea of podcasting came out, it was a real compromise on whether it was the amount of people that you could reach or the amount of impact that you could have. And now I'll contend, you know, and of course, everybody, you know, stay tuned to WGN Radio right here in Chicago. But there are so many things that people are doing on the podcasting side where you can make an argument that, yeah, you could reach more people, you know, and you can make a really good argument. You could reach more people in the podcast forum. And I think the word is out. That cat is specifically out of the bag. And so, you know, the kind of power that you can have. So to see it from getting into it where you just wanted to kind of have a voice, right, to share a voice, and specifically in something you had a passion for, and now where it's really like the possibilities are endless.
You're right. Radio is great. Like, here we're on WGN. It's a blowtorch. You're getting multiple states and countries. I mean, this thing is wicked. But it's just for the people that are passing through that reach. And maybe they're hearing us right now, and we spark some kind of interest, and they look you up, they look me up, whatever. But they continue on to Washington State or San Diego or wherever they're actually headed. For podcast, it is everybody that's going to listen to me. We have some kind of common bond right off the bat. You've gone into iTunes or Google Podcast or whatever your podcast platform picker is, and you've typed in BBQ or barbecue, the full name spelling, and now you have a list of things to choose from, and you check out my show. Well, I already know if, Dane, this is the first time you've ever listened to Barbecue Central show, you Googled or you typed in those words BBQ, So you like that already, and I like that already. So there's a show that you might like. Now, when you tune into it, maybe you don't like my personality. Maybe you don't like the fact that I have the sound effects, you know, whatever, that might eventually turn you off. But the hook, or what I find to be great about podcasts, is if I'm, as a listener, searching out something, then I know there has to be some time or some kind of common ground that I'm going to like, regardless of whether I end up liking the host or not, because I'm looking for it, and that's the hook.
Yeah, people don't just find themselves washing up on the shores of the BBC Central.
You're searching that out. You're hitting the subscribe button. You know, I mean, that's the best part of the whole thing.
So the conversations and how they've changed from a Greg reaching out to, like, how can I make my ribs not suck, all the way now to the conversations changing, and I want to say inside baseball, but where people that are there, like you mentioned, they're already informed, in tune, enthused. They're excited about what's happening in the barbecue world. And how can you not be? Because I think that your just everything that you've done and kind of the evolution of it has really converged with really a national. And I think maybe you could make a case that you're maybe part of it in some way, that the country, the world, really, you could make a case for, is excited about barbecue. So the conversations have changed from, hey, I need a little help not to make my stuff or to make my stuff better, to really as sort of that conduit for information when breaking news happens, when personalities are doing things, when they're bringing out books, when KCBS has a brand new kind of a revolutionary change at the top, you know, they're going to come and they're going to talk to you. So how does it feel to be sort of that guy?
Right? It's a new thing, because it hadn't really happened where I had been approached. It's now been twice this year where a big entity to us, the American Royal leadership, says, hey, we want to announce this year's Barbecue Hall of Fame, people that make it into the Barbecue Hall of Fame, the class of 2019, live on your show before we put it out on any other media. And then a month or so ago, there's a big change over at the Kansas City Barbecue Society, where they've installed a new CEO, and they want to make that announcement live on my show. And it's, I mean, for me, it's really gratifying, because, you know, there's certainly the whole news, I'm breaking it, blah, 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 and nobody knows before you hear it on my show. But I think it continues to lend a legitimacy and a belief by the folks within the industry that, if, regardless of how many other barbecue shows there are, if you want to hear what's happening right now, including live late-breaking stuff, you have to come to the Barbecue Central show, or you have to get it right after it ends, or however you're going to consume it, because it's coming here first, and then it'll dribble down the line and everybody else will get a piece.
Also, the opportunity to interact live with it, to, like, add your opinion to...
Some of it's a little out of the ordinary, so there's no pork ribs there. I'm sorry, there is pork ribs. There's no pulled pork there, but they do have traditional St. Louis-style ribs. They have lamb ribs, which you don't usually find at barbecue places, that are really good. They have some Cleveland-based sides and sandwiches, like bratwurst sandwich. Some of the sides, like you get the pig cracklings with this Lawson dip, which Lawson's is a specific Cleveland company, so he incorporates that. The mustard-based barbecue sauce, which, if you go on Yelp, seems to be everybody's biggest complaint, is there isn't a selection of sauces. It's one mustard-based sauce. That mustard, by the way, is a ballpark mustard, Burtman's, which happens to be located in Cleveland. So he does a really good job at trying to tie some Cleveland-based things in and some European things in to the menu. But in my opinion, this is a very Texas-inspired menu, from the look, from how it's served on the trays with the butcher paper, the brisket. The spices are a little bit different. Pastrami-rubbed beef rib, which is really good.
Oh, that sounds good.
But, I mean, it's, to me, it's classically Texas-inspired, even though he positions it as Cleveland barbecue.
That's great. I mean, that's really great to hear, kind of the in-depth breakdown of the thing, you know, because he's a celebrity chef and probably the biggest culinary name, right?
Oh, no doubt.
Right.
For
so,
sure.
And he's a huge, you know, ambassador for Cleveland, big fan of Cleveland, always talking about it and all that kind of stuff, and lamenting on the Browns and all the things that people complain about when it comes to.
A lot of lamenting.
Yes, there's always the lamenting. But when you come to a place like Chicago, and it's great to have you here, and this is not your first visit here to our fair city, this is an opportunity that you've had a couple times. You mentioned Green Street. Of course, our good friend, you know, Barry from Smoke is great. There's a lot of cool places. Is there any places that you make a point not to miss, or that you're looking forward to going next time?
So this is technically, I would call this my maiden voyage eating through Chicago.
Oh, wow.
The last couple times The most recent time before this, I was in Rosemont. So
there's
a
Bub City out there.
I was out. Yeah. Hit a Gibson's, which was a
really
good steak.
Great. Yeah.
But no, that was like the venture out.
That's really good.
Because I'm inside a convention center, that big dome out there in Rosemont by the airport.
Yep.
And then the year before that, I was downtown, but again, volleyball. So I was inside a lot. So not a lot of eating. I think I went to the Weber restaurant with Meathead from AmazingRibs.com.
Nice.
And he's got I don't know if you had heard, but he's got this barbecue stars.
A new video series.
Yes. So, it's kind of like master class, but it's all barbecue related, not to get off topic. But so this time around, my middle daughter's in for some modeling thing at the Mart. So she's tied up all day and I'm left to my devices and I like to eat. So I went out Saturday and hit Au Cheval. And
The burger?
Yes.
Okay.
I mean,
how was it? Okay. So
that was all I've heard about for like 3 years. Well, but I also heard that the line is like Franklin's barbecue, and I've often said that no matter how good Franklin's is, you will never catch me waiting in line for 3 or 4 or more hours, because there's something that has to happen physically to me if I'm waiting that long that I know isn't going to happen.
Well, but I think, too, is part of it is I think that if you could just go in there and be surprised, be amazed, be astonished by that burger and be like, whoa, I didn't know it could be like this. But when there's so much hype, it's hard to like live up to because the expectations are so different. You know, unless you get, I guess maybe there's a kind of sliding scale of expectations and then just you've resigned yourself. You're going to think it's awesome no matter what.
Well, the good news is this. At 10:45 on a Sunday, there was no line. I walked right in. They sat me right at the bar. It was just me. And I got the double cheeseburger, got the thick-cut bacon, got the egg on top, of course. And it was visually a delight. You know, there's a lot of other nerdy things that are going on in that place. I mean, it's super small, which I prefer, which I can also see how that adds to the line situation when that happens. And then like behind the burger bar, you have like 5 or 6 people all working in concert. The flat top's going. The guy's doing the fries. One guy's cooking the eggs. I mean, there were so many wonderful, attractive things that were going on at Au Cheval when I was there. It was great. To top it off, the burger absolutely met expectation and all the hype. Not having to wait in the line probably helped with that, too.
Yeah.
But it was really good. The bun was really good. It was like a brioche bun. The patties were really good, well-cooked, a little pink in the middle, juicy. Cheese is good. The bacon's good. I mean, it was a great burger. And then I walked right across the street and went to Green Street Barbecue, got a half pound of brisket because, to me, that's the measure of, I mean, make really good pulled pork. I can make really good ribs. But to see a restaurant pull off brisket is kind of the standard to me. And I got a piece of the lean, piece of the fatty. They were both really good. And Dr. Barbecue actually told me that they took a lot of inspiration for his barbecue restaurant down in Tampa from Green Street as far as...
I was there with him while he was doing the recon.
Yeah,
you know?
They're doing like all the tasting and the profiles, and they were really taken with that for Dr. Barbecue's restaurant down there. So he's like, you know, this is an important place for me. And so it was great to have really good barbecue there. But it was a great experience for sure. I did Parlor Pizza. And then right before I came up here, I did the Billy Goat cheeseburger. And,
Let
me tell you, man,
I
saw a lot of hate on the reviews for that place.
For the Billy Goat?
Yes.
Well, it's so there are some places that people have, I think, a romantic attachment to for whatever reason, whether it's part of Saturday Night Live or that was part of, you know, there was a lot of, you know, media entities, the Tribune and and it's kind of right under the street for the listeners who haven't been there.
Yes.
So there's a lot of people that had lunch there it's an iconic location, a great people watching location. People can come down, you know, on one side or the other on whether the food is special or whether it's the ambiance of the history that you're tasting. I don't know.
I'm a Saturday Night Live nerd. So that aspect of it was already a winner for me. And to see where it was underneath the bridge, which was kind of weird. it's like always nighttime there. And then to go in, you walk down, you see the guy behind the flat top. I mean, there was no like cheeseburger, cheeseburger.
Right.
Like they're doing the skit, but I mean, of course, I ordered that. It was the double cheeseburger, and I put a couple pickles and mustard ketchup, and that was it. The bun was really good. Like, I thought the bun made the burger. I mean, the burger was good. I mean, not life-changing, but all in all, as you said, there was a romance that happened within those 30 minutes that was good. And I mean, I would go there again.
It isn't even just like the Saturday Night Live stuff. Obviously, that brought us sort of national prominence but here, local Chicago lore and sports legends, you know, with the GOAT and, you know, not getting into Wrigley Field and the Cubs and all that kind of stuff. So there's a lot of great stories to tell. We're going to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about the show, what people are going to hear, when they can hear it. We'll talk a little bit about, I think, some changes in KCBS and what Greg sees for the future of barbecue, not only for people in their backyards and all over the place in the membership, but also those great personalities. So keep it here, 720 WGN. Here she comes again when she's dancing beneath the starry sky. 720 WGN. Hi, atop Chicago in the Skyline Studio. Dane here with you until 5 a.m. in for Nick D. And riding shotgun for tonight's show, we've got Dino Tiberi with us, Tom Hush in the booth. We've got a couple fun stories coming up, some fun and some a little bit scary, right? Cautionary tales. And so just to kind of like tease them that we're going to talk about over the next hour is, you know, the emotional support animal phenomenon has been, it's been out there. And I think it's been the kind of thing that I think some of us, you know, have to acknowledge that animals have a role in making us feel comfortable and secure in a bunch of different situations that may be stressful, like going to the store or riding a plane or mountain biking or whatever.
You're gonna doing anything.
And support animal, we've often thought of a seeing eye dog or some kind of a dog that will come with you and help you. Certainly, they're great at it, right? So that's part of it. But you know, Tom, isn't there been, you know, where people trying to bring like a peacock on a plane or
a squirrel,
an ocelot, you know?
I don't know if we've gotten into that level of wild cat.
A support wallaby, you know, you never know what you're going to do. So we'll talk about it. So 312-981-7200. If you have an animal like this that you'd like to share, maybe give a shout out to that certain special someone or something.
Or, you know, your animal, the koala bear.
Or your koala bear. Now, I've heard they've gotten a bad rap, certainly famous and cuddly from all of the Qantas airline commercials. But I've heard that they're nasty and that they smell. Is that true?
They're incredibly mean. I went to a zoo in Sydney when I was a kid. And I met a koala for the first time, and it was awful.
Incredibly mean. So this, you talk about things and people getting a bad rap. But the koala, I think, has got a good rap. Because they're just nasty. I think on YouTube you can find a lot of koala attack videos. you laugh, but it's happening.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. Right. So we're going to talk about trying to do this, whether it's a situation that could be stressful, like getting fired. In New Zealand, a man brings a support clown to his firing. So we're going to talk about that in 312-91-7200 if you have any. Dina, have you ever, just to inspire people to maybe think to themselves, have you ever had a support? Granted, like a pet is a support animal, but one, I guess, that isn't the key that you bring it with you everywhere. That's the difference between that and a pet.
Yeah.
I have never had a support animal, but my niece has one.
A real one? Yeah. Or like a, I mean, like a clown to the...
No, she's got a German Shepherd that's a support animal for her.
Nice. Okay, so this is happening. 312-981-7200. Then the other story that is in the news that is headlines everywhere. Woman swallows engagement ring in sleep, thinking it was all a dream. Now, this is not funny. Certainly will be laughing, and there's a happy ending here, but... we'll talk about sleepwalking. You know, if you've done some things in your sleep that maybe were strange, right? Tom Hush has got some. Dino, I know off the air, talked about it as well. So quick break, and coming up, the news or the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn in the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. Keep it here. We'll be back, 720 WGN. Hi, atop Chicago, Allstate Skylines. Well, it's not Allstate Skylines. So I'm just so used to saying it so many times, right? Yep, just the Skyline. We're here. Dane is here with you until 5 a.m. in for Nick DiGilio, who is a little under the weather today and yesterday. He will be back tonight, I am sure of it. To my right, Dino Tiberi in studio with us, and Tom Hush in as well. And a phenomenon that we talked about, we teased a little bit beforehand, and Dino, one of your relatives has an emotional or a support animal, you know, and I think we think of oftentimes it would be, you know, a dog, right? A seeing eye dog, or even just a support dog, maybe for a veteran or for somebody. So dogs are kind of typical in there. There's been some unusual I think right, the whole support thing has been less defined as a dog. It could be almost anything. Something
support that, llama.
A support llama,
sure,
would be great. Not great in every situation. So this is the thing, and Tom had printed this out that kind of brought the topic to light when copywriter Josh Thompson received an ominous email from his bosses asking to discuss his role at the company. He knew he was facing redundancy, and in that neck of the woods, as you spin the globe, and it means that he's good. Going to be fired, right? He's looking at his job. He's going to be terminated. The human resource department in New Zealand encouraged him to bring a support person. Ooh, so they were asking for it to help cushion the blow, an option that is legally required in New England. Well, once they tell you to, hey, because it could be like a celebratory person, right? Somebody to high five, maybe. Let's say it was a promotion, because they don't tell you in the meeting that it, or that come to this meeting for some bad news. Bring somebody who can drive.
That's when normally the person would duck out and go, I'm not going to that meeting.
Yeah. But rather than bring a family member, a friend, or even a pet, the part-time stand-up comedian, well, they knew they were in for that, decided to spend $100 or so probably on a clown called Joe. I was working because they had a job back then. I got an email, and the email said, hi, Josh, we'd like to meet with you to discuss some matters in regards to your role. He told the BBC from Australia, where he's been making the most of not having a job. So he's okay, at least at this point. Basically, I sensed I was going to be fired, so I thought I might as well try to make the best of the situation. So Joe accompanied Joe, this clown, emotional support clown, accompanied Josh for the meeting when the clown made balloon animals. Although he had to be told to stop a few times, it was difficult to hear above the screeching of the plastic. Boy, they're noisy. So you think of, this is, I think, a teachable moment. It's one thing to bring in the support clown, and maybe your potential future ex-employer could say, wow, this guy is really, you know, thinking outside the box here. This is fun. You know, he's got a clown.
Or he's just a loon.
Or he's crazy. Right. It's good to get him out of here. But I think maybe, Tom and Dina, let me know what you think. Maybe your emotional support attorney could be there, you know, with some sort of, like,
I don't know. I like the idea of the clown, because it's like, hey, sorry, we're going to get rid of all your health care, your salary. It's going to be really hard to pay your mortgage, but, you know. Isn't that fun?
No, come on. He's on.
That's perfect.
He was on Team Josh. He was on the team getting. He wasn't there to like make fun of it. And so he said, when Josh finally was delivered the hammer blow that he was about to lose his job, the clown reacted accordingly. He nodded his head along when I received the bad news, as if he was also receiving bad news. It was totally professional. And so I think they can, these emotional support entities, whether it's a clown or. Or a person or an animal or whatever, or a dog, can kind of help soften the blow, or even in other situations, help you feel more comfortable, more prepared for situations. So, Dino, one of your family members has an emotional support dog, right? You mentioned that a little bit of anxiety and to have the animal with.
Well, you know, I'm not sure what all of the underlying things are, but, you know, her dog's name's Uno, and it's a, you know, and she has her at college with her, so it's...
Oh, that's great. I think, and to fend off any, you know, any situations that you may... It's always good to have a dog there. I think dogs are universally on the other side, accepted by whether it's, you know, planes or whether it's, you know, different... Whether it's stores or businesses or buildings or whatever, people understand that, you know, a dog is going to be potentially that person or that support entity that's going to be in there. Now, some of the ones that aren't as... I don't know, accepted or typical, but are out there now as respected and important support animals. So 312-9170-200, if anybody has one that they have or have heard of that is outside of this list, or something kind of interesting or funny. So a support pig in November 2014, a pig was removed from a U.S. Airway flight after it became disruptive. The passenger on the plane told ABC News the pig was tethered to an armrest.
What?
Looking back and forth, eventually both the pig and the human owner were asked to leave the flight. So even a small pig, even those pot-belly pigs, they're pretty big, right? And just to, like, put the other people through that, I don't know. Have you ever seen
that? I don't know. I'd be okay with that. I think pigs are actually real cool.
Well, See, you'd be...
That's thinking outside the box right there, Tom. I'm with you on that. I think pigs are cool.
Yeah, you bring on your little, you know... I don't know how big the pig was. Well, I mean, it's certainly not a full-grown pig.
A pot-belly pig, right? A small one?
You would hope, right?
Yeah, there's a 400-pounder. Bring him on.
Yeah.
He takes up two seats.
Well, but here's the thing. So, you've all been on a plane. We've all been on a plane. So, they had it tethered to the armrest, and it was walking up and down the aisle. So, let's say you needed to get up, use the lavatory. You'd have to hurdle the pig...
Or have you never been on a plane where you've had to hurdle a person? People are just basically children on planes are animals.
Yes.
Except they're not emotionally supportive. They're emotionally disruptive.
Yes. Right.
I'm climbing over 5-year olds just to go to the bathroom. Hush.
Yeah, the one that's been kicking you for the
Okay.
Oh, boy.
All right. Moving on. The other one. So now this one, I think, just from size wise, and you can, you know, put it under your arm like a football, is an emotional sport duck. Carla Fitzgerald was flying between Charlotte, Nashville, and North Carolina when she was papped with her feathery friend, a duck named Daniel Turducken Stinkerbutt. That is not from the post-game show. This is not a Mitch Trubisky thing. The PTSD sufferer had been hit by a taxi driver in 2013, later received certification to take Mr. Stinkerbutt with her onboard flights as an emotional support pet. Ducks are very friendly, and they don't make a ton. I mean, they can quack, so obviously they've got their, you know, traditional barnyard noise, but they're small enough they could sit on your lap, and that works better than the pig, I think. What do you think?
You know what? Why not put it right next to you? What the heck? You'd be fine by me. I don't know. That's just my opinion.
All right. Emotional support cat. Now, cats typically, and they're one of the most famous team photo of popular pets out there. Cats are right in there.
Big fan of cats.
But they're all thought of, or oftentimes thought of, being as kind of aloof and kind of...
skittish.
Unconnected. You know, so like... I don't know that I would think of them as emotionally supporting you. They would maybe emotionally abandoning you, typically, right? As far as the cat.
The clawed cat or a regular?
Well, let's read on. Donna Weigel was on a flight between Baltimore and Chicago when she saw a passenger at a gate with a cat. The asthmatic alerted officials to her respiratory problems and the allergy to cats, but soon found herself sitting on board just a few rows away from the feline passenger. The result, Weigel was removed from the plane to avoid a medical incident and rebooked to another United Airlines flight driven from Baltimore to Washington Dulles and reached Chicago 5 hours late. Meow. So sometimes, it's, you know, it's although you feel there. Like, and maybe even it's for you, that you're bringing attention to the maybe a emotional support animal that shouldn't be there, sometimes it could backfire, right, where they're going to kick you off the plane and not the cat.
You and your cat, get out.
Well, as someone who's allergic to dogs, I always, you know, it's one of those things where it's like, I can't be mad at people for having dogs. Like, they don't own dogs. Like, their ability to own a dog should not be contingent on whether or not I can come visit them in their home. But when it comes to the cat thing, yeah, if you're bringing that cat out into the public, that's kind of a different deal. When you're bringing an animal into a space where someone might be allergic and not really able to do anything about it. Yeah, it's got to be the person with the cat that gets off.
And you don't always have to bring, and this is just a spitball in here, but you don't always have to bring the emotional support animal with you. You can sometimes go to an emotional support, let's say an oasis of cats, like Tom Hush did, I think I saw on social media, where you were surrounded, maybe you were coated in cats, right?
Well, I went to a cat cafe because...
Come get your emotional support right here, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I give to a good... You know, I pay $15 and I get an hour with a bunch of really nice cats. They're just looking for a home. I can't take them because my younger brother, who lives with me, is allergic to cats.
Oh, boy.
Come on.
So I can't take the cat home. Exactly. So I get to have my cat time, and, you know, I'm helping to pay for their continued living situation.
So that's another possibility, right? You don't always have to take it with you. You could go to it. Go to the
emotional
support, right? Okay, so we disclose, I don't know if we're breaking any news here, about the dark side of the koala situation, right? Is that koalas, as cute as they may be, are both stinky and really
and
mean. Angry and mean. So now monkeys, who have, I think, a position of, think Curious George, Dino.
Sure.
This is a guy that's been with you through childhood. He's been there. Curious.
One of the first books I ever read.
Yeah, or any, or Spraddle and Chim Chim from Speed Racer. You know, I think the monkey has been around and is a big part of everything. But they also have situations where they're known to be stinky, And also mean.
Well, that was in The Wizard of Oz.
Those are like fake flying monkeys.
Oh, flying monkeys.
Yeah. Right. But, and also known to throw their own feces, right? This happens, right? So, okay, monkey. But I could see how they would get along. You know,
an emotional support monkey.
Yeah, I mean, if it was dependent on the monkey. In 2016, Jason Ellis found himself in trouble when he tried to fly with his emotional support marmoset, which is kind of like a monkey. The trouble wasn't the miniature monkey, but rather Ellis's failure to produce the correct paperwork. The misunderstanding, in a mere quoting here, was resolved when the plane landed in Las Vegas, but unfortunately, Ellis was unable to fly back to Ohio after being put on the Frontier Airlines no-fly list. So sometimes you can get through.
And then you're never allowed to get back on a plane again.
In the airline, in an official capacity, says, let's not do this again, right? And the last one that I'm going to mention here, other than the horse, because that seems really hard to do, but is a turkey. In January 2016, a passenger was able to provide Delta Airlines with paperwork proving that a turkey was their emotional support. What's the proving? Like the judge asked, do you really mean it? Like, do you really love Mr. Gobbler? And he's like, I really do. Okay, there you go.
I can't be without my turkey.
The bird even received VIP treatment as it was rolled through the airport in a wheelchair.
Oh,
turkeys
goodness. Can
get big, Dino.
Oh, yeah.
We know that. One Reddit user who reposted the picture, my neighbor is a flight attendant. He just posted this photo of someone's therapy pet on his flight as a turkey. Yep. So some of these decisions can be made, whether you're, you know, just making like clear-headed, conscious decisions. And some bad decisions get made while you're sleeping and while you're sleepwalking. When we come back from this break, we're going to talk a little bit about that woman who swallowed her engagement ring in her sleep, thinking it was all a dream. And then our own stories, plus yours, 312-981-7200. Dino, you've got some stories. Tom, you do as well. Keep it here. 720 WGN. WGN, high atop Chicago, Allstate Skyline Studio here in for Nick DiGilio until 5 a.m. And Eddie Money, she was shaking. A woman swallows engagement ring in her sleep, thinking it was all a dream. Now, this is a phenomenon. I don't know that I've had family members who have done the whole sleepwalking thing. It's one thing to sleepwalk, and you guys both, Dino and Tom, have experience with this. We'll get into this story. This is on the news. Now is a California woman who dreamed of swallowing her engagement ring says she woke up to discover it had actually happened, leaving her in need of an emergency medical procedure to extract the sparkly morsel. So not only was she doing things that she shouldn't have been doing, like eating her jewelry, but she also had a whole kind of weird scenario. Jenna Evans of San Diego sleepwalking on Tuesday night when she said she swallowed her 2.4 carat diamond after dreaming that she was on a high-speed train and the only way to protect her ring from approaching bad guys was to swallow it. So the diamond engagement ring was removed from California woman's stomach last week. She swallowed it while she was sleepwalking. And so she woke up without it. She had to explain it to her fiancé.
Where is it?
Bobby. And I guess Bobby was skeptical. Well, as anyone, the little story, it's really like it's truth is stranger than fiction. But they did an x-ray, and it was proved that she wasn't lying. And then they laughed pretty hard for about an hour, and they called the mom. And then they were laughing, and then they were crying. And so then they got it out. They said that it was easier, or at least more important, to go ahead and just get out with an endoscopy. So they went in and pulled the ring out, as opposed to have it travel
through the
normal way. And the reason was she was really happy because she didn't know if she could look at it and appreciate it the same way if she had to search for it. So I guess, you know, if you're thinking, hey, you never know where this ring has been, you know, if you have to pull it out of, you know, your poop. So anyway, so that's an interesting thing, a story here. Things can happen. You can go ahead and swallow things that you shouldn't have. And I've heard of sleepwalkers being able to go to the refrigerator and get a snack or, you know, a beverage or something, and these things happen. So, Dino, this happened to you, right? So is this something that's like a regular thing, or was it when you were a kid once?
Oh, mine was actually, I went to a Bulls game, and then and this is a true story, go to a Bulls game, I come home after the game, I go to sleep. In the middle of the night, I get up, and I had one of those old globes that you had on a stand.
Yeah.
Where you could just pull it off, and then you could, you know, like a ball, you could take a look at it up above your head.
Okay.
Somehow it was already, I took it off there.
Walked, so you got up.
I got up out of bed. I picked up the globe, walked out into the hallway, and shot a jump shot down the stairs.
Whoa.
And then there was a loud crash, and my dad woke up and said, what are you doing? And I just, like, didn't even, I went back, I turned and went right back to bed.
Wow.
I'm shooting threes, Dad.
Yeah, shooting threes, Dad. Don't worry about me.
So your dad or family members, they told you, like, here's what you did, so they relayed? Yeah. Or did you remember any of it?
I remembered some of it, but then, he only saw the end of the
result.
Right,
the crashing and
See me get up, but he put two and two together and told me, you had the globe and you threw it down the stairs.
Now, you said he said that he yelled at you and you went kind of just back.
I just went back to bed,
but he didn't wake you up, because they always say, oh, you shouldn't. And I saw a couple clips of, like, stepbrothers.
Yeah, that's the best. When they're both doing it.
Don't wake them up and they're throwing the presents. Wow. Okay. So is it just that one time as far as you know?
Yeah, I mean, that was the one that I remember. I mean, I'm sure I did it after that, but.
Wow.
But my brother had an incident where he got up and instead of making it into the bathroom, he just stopped and urinated right into a plant.
He was in the bathroom. Wow. Okay. Now, were these. In any way, could you attribute to it anything that you like eaten or had to drink or anything like that?
Me, no. Mine was just because I went to the basketball game.
Right?
Just reenacted the scene from the game down when I shot the globe down the stairs.
Wow. Okay.
But my brother, obviously that was just from, had to go to the bathroom. He drank whatever water.
Yeah. Whatever. Well, I've had dreams where in my dream I have to go to the bathroom, and so then you're trying to, like, figure out to find the bathroom. You can't find it. It's kind of
that's kind of what happened to him.
You're kind of a thing. So in the end, like, the actual real thing that you're going through is kind of incorporated into the dream. Like, if you leave the TV on and Tony Little's doing an infomercial, eventually there he is in your dream on a gazelle. So, no, Tom, you've had a similar experience or different?
Yeah, so I'm a chronic sleepwalker. I sleepwalk fairly frequently, usually about once or twice a week.
Strap yourself down, like Wolf, on the full moon kind of thing?
no, thankfully no, because it's gotten less and less severe in terms of what I'll do. Most of the time I'll, like, get up and just walk around a bit and then just come back and go back to bed. My girlfriend will just, like, watch me and see where I go, make sure I don't go and do anything stupid.
Now, how can she tell if you're really awake, because you're doing awake type things?
She'll try to get my attention, and usually she won't be able to get my attention, but the problem is that I also sleep talk, and I will hold full conversations with people, but they always realize that I'm still unconscious because they don't make any sense. So there was one time I was between places.
Thank goodness.
We were waiting to move into our new place, but we were out of our old apartment. So we were staying at my cousin's house on the northwest side. And I tend to sleepwalk more and more severely when I'm in unfamiliar places. So this was a fairly unfamiliar place. While my cousin and her husband were on a trip, they left us, to stay in their home, kind of watch and house sit. And one night, I fell asleep a little early. And my girlfriend was up reading when all of a sudden my eyes just popped right open. And she says, Tom, you awake? And I didn't really say anything until I looked straight in her eyes and I said, well, I guess this is how you die.
Oh, no.
And she looks at me like, is he going to murder me? And I was just staring at, like, just total thousand-yard stare right at her, mm-hmm. right at her face. She said, are you awake right now? And I said, of course I'm awake, Lauren. And she's like, do you realize what you just said to me?
Is that her name?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
At least that
No,
was...
at least it's her name. And she's like, okay, do you know what you're saying to me right now? Yes, Lauren, it's the plot of The Mummy Returns. And I just get up and start storming around the house. And she's like, do you know what time it is? I'm like, it's pitch black, Lauren. Of course I don't know what time it is. And I go to the bathroom, come back out, go to bed, out like a light.
Do you ever think they ever film you doing that?
She's tried to, but once she realizes that it's happening, it's already too late.
Too late.
Usually only goes on for maybe a minute or so, and I'll be back in bed. Yeah. There have been times where I've been talking to her about fulfilling prescriptions or something, and she's like, what are you talking? It's 2 o'clock in the morning.
You need that Xanax. You better get a hold of some of that.
So I'm pretty bad when it comes to that.
Wow.
Full conversations. People sometimes cannot tell if I'm unconscious or not.
Is that, and you wonder, is there anything that maybe you, because some people, they say, like, oh, if you drink warm milk or, you know, or whatever, you'll have bad dreams, something. There's different things that you can go ahead and have that people have attributed to either bad dreams or maybe something like this. Is there anything that you've, like, known to kind of stay away from?
No, not really, because it just kind of happens at random. I try to do my best to not look at too many screens before I go to bed. That seems to kind of help. But as they say, the term, I believe, the scientific term is somnambulism. Well, to be a somnambulist, and that's just what I am.
Well, to imply that this is how we find out how someone dies, you know, you think if you watch enough of those true crime shows with Bill Curtis, that might be a decent defense, right?
I was sleepwalking, man. Didn't know what I was doing.
Got a history of this. Just listen to the rebroadcast of this program.
And then there's Tom, who we found to be a sleepwalker. And there he went.
And a sleep killer.
All right. Okay. No, it's not. He's not a sleep killer. He just watches movies and gets his prescriptions filled. That's what he does. All right. It is 4:30, and we're going to take a quick... Are we going to take a quick break and then come back and send it to news? That's what we're going to do, 720 WGN. I know tonight she comes. 720 WGN. It is Dane here with you until 5 a.m. in for Nick DiGilio. A little bit under weather yesterday. I'm sure he'll be back in action tonight. Dino Tiberi is to my right. Tom Hush in the booth as well. And before we went to the news, we were talking a little bit about some of the things that are going on. A little bit early in the program, we were breaking down some of the Bears' season, attributing a little bit to the extra challenges that they face on the schedule side, and then also some of the things that they're going to have to do on the team side as well. And Dino, when it comes to the Bears, I know we're kind of going through the schedule and deciding like
games are going to win and who
this is a
lose.
This is a loss. And you know, if you can have whether it's a lobster that decides who's going to win the Super Bowl or maybe a monkey that chooses things, we can do that. But you have sort of that perception of it. I think we were at where the Giants game.
Yeah, we were down to the Giants. Let me see where that is. That's right before Thanksgiving when they take on the Lions. So, yeah, the Giants win for the Bears. I think they beat the Giants at home. And then the Lions and the Bears at Detroit.
That's a tough one because that's the Thanksgiving kind of situation.
So it's rare that they play the same. They did that last year. They played at Thanksgiving in Detroit last year, too. They normally don't schedule the same team twice for those games, so... It's just weird. I mean, that's a ratings bonanza, apparently. I don't know the reason why they'd have it that way. But, yeah, so they play the Lions. I think that would be a win.
I think Detroit has the ability to lose, whether it's a holiday or not.
It doesn't make any difference. They can lose whatever
they've
day
shown
it is.
A capacity to lose in many situations.
Yeah. The Bears then will be playing the Dallas Cowboys on a Thursday night at home. And that's going to be a tough game.
I think they've got a chance to win. Hopefully, at that point, they've kind of righted the ship in a bunch of different ways. They've kind of got things clicking on all cylinders, no pun intended, and they'll have the ability to go ahead and win some of these games. When you think about even the games that they lost last year, you know, there were some... We talk about the schedule, but they're playing like New England. And
They played them close.
Wasn't it like, I think the entire, you know, all the losses in the season added up to less than 14
points?
Yeah,
it didn't seem like it. You're right. I agree. To wrap up the last three games of the year, the Bears go to Green Bay in December on the 15th. That's a daunting task there. That could be a tough one. And then the Bears come back home on a Sunday night and take on the Chiefs.
Okay.
That's going to be another tough game because Kansas City's a good team.
Yeah. What's with all these good teams?
I know. You get a first-place schedule, this is a prize you get. Yeah. And then they end the season... The regular season in Minnesota against the Vikings. So
you want to get to the that one's there's a win right there. So you got that. So you want to get to the Super Bowl and win it. You're going to have to beat some of those teams, you know. And those are the teams you're going to have to play. And they've got the talent to do it. We mentioned some of the moves that they made on the offensive side, and you've got the running game, which was great, and you've got that defense, which has got all the talent that they need. And Mitch Trubisky, hopefully, Hamp and OB and Cos will have some more. But I think that they're kind of a little tough love, right? I think the Bears could even do relatively well, and there'd still be some criticism that they should be doing things better.
There's always going to be somebody saying something like that because it's never perfect for everybody.
Never. It's never perfect for everybody. So here's a situation that has not gone perfectly since the Cubs won the World Series. You know, looking to kind of, you know, while that proverbial window is still open, you know, this is a team that has now hit more home runs than they ever have in the history of the franchise. And so the offense, if you're looking at trying to get things going on the offensive side of things, you know, scoring probably over the last few games an average of 15 runs. And you always say, right, and I see on social media sometimes, you know, you'd be like, well, save some.
Save a few right. for tomorrow.
Yeah, just like, right, like ration these out.
Right, those, we don't need to use them all now.
You know, when the going gets tough, you're going to need a couple extra runs. I don't know if that's attributed to them really kind of getting things together, or is it obviously the bad pitching for the Pirates has a lot to do with it as well.
I think it's a combination of both things, Dane, the good hitting and horrible pitching. I can't make it more simple than that.
So when we talk scheduling, whether it's the Bears or maybe the Cubs, this is the schedule that you want. Going forward, though, and let's talk about it. So it's the kind of thing that the Cardinals, regardless of who they lose in free agency, who leaves or retires or whatever, the system that they've gotten in place has led to them, you know, outside of a big market. You know, the Yankees can just write checks and just buy the best players every year. But the Cardinals, you know, as much as you like to criticize them, you got to give them some props because they're always just kind of reloading and always right there at the end.
Well, right now the Cubs have been lucky. The last couple of seasons they've been able to make the playoff. But this year it looks like they're going to be in one way or the other, whether it's a wild card or the division winner. And you're right, Dan, they just keep restocking, whether it's with power arms or with some quality bats or a combination of both. And they contend every year. I mean, no matter what, even when they're not in the playoffs, they still play the Cubs tough. And this year is no different. So seven more games left in the next couple of weeks. Between the Cub and the Cardinals are going to tell the tale in the division and also in the wild card. So, you know, right now the Cubs are two behind the Cardinals for the division lead. And they've got the Reds here for the next three games. And then the Cardinals come in next weekend. And that's the end of their home games for the regular season. And so then they go on the road to play Pittsburgh and end up in St. Louis. So the next 2 weeks are going to go quickly, and we're going to find out whether the Cubs, when the smoke clears, are going to be there at
the end. Yeah, whether they're going to be there at the end. Of course, last year, you know, the Brewers, you know, it's like Haley's Comet. Every once in a great, great while, something magical happens, and Robin Yount's on the team. So then they ended up, you know, having a great season and are having a really good season, and I think they're only a game or so behind the Cubs at this point. But Christian Yelich, you know, the MVP, on his way to having another like awesome season, injured, out for the season. Is this the end for them, or can they pull it together? They had a good pitching staff, and they had a lot of good players. It wasn't just all him, but he was a lot.
Yeah, their pitching's been down a little bit this year, but they've been able to persevere while not having Yelich in the lineup. They've continued to win ball games. It remains to be seen whether they can continue that for the last couple of weeks of the season, but I think their schedule is not that daunting. So it could be a matter of they could get on a run. The Cubs only have a one-game cushion, as you said, so it's going to be difficult. But I think that in the end, the Cubs will sneak in there. I think they're going to get there.
Now, do they need to have kind of that momentum? It's one thing to sort of get into the playoffs. We saw what happened last year where you kind of just like limp in and then you kind of just crawl up and right. You're not strong enough to really get anything done. And the playoff run, especially, we saw it, I think, even after the World Series where they got in, they still, you know, it's tough to make that long run and have everything that you need. All the things have to go right, and then they have to go even more right.
Yeah, you've got to have all the things together, especially from a health perspective. And now, you know, Anthony Rizzo twists his ankle on a play today, and they're going to do an MRI on him tomorrow. The timing couldn't have been worse for that to happen, for him to have that come down right now. And you know, they're still looking to get their closer back, and there's, you know, a couple, and Baez is out, so they're missing some pieces right now, and it's going to be difficult to get it done. I think they're going to get in the playoffs. I don't know how far they get. Maybe they don't even win the wild card. We'll have to see, because right now, Yu Darvish is your best option pitching. And who would have thought that a year ago?
I would not.
Would you
have thought that?
Nah, there's no chance. Yeah. No chance. So it'll be interesting to see what happens there, and you know, from the north side of Chicago. But we could talk briefly about the Sox.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say, because this is a team, obviously, you know, WGN Radio, the flagship
absolutely
for the Mighty White Sox, and this is a team that had the building blocks. They're putting things together. Some challenges on the injury side with some of the prospects, but this is a team that's got some good players, made some strides. They're getting closer every year.
Patience is the key for the White Sox fans out there. They're just going to have to wait a little bit longer to get their team back together because they've lost a lot of pitching due to injury, but you know they're getting some valuable experience, and they've been competitive during the season. Even though the record might not necessarily show where they're over 500, they've been in a lot of ball games, and I think they're going to be a team you're going to have to watch out for the next couple of years once they get these guys back healthy and they're able to continue to build on the success that some of their young players have. And we'll have to wait and see what happens next year in spring training. And while these guys wrap up the season, I think they got some valuable experience. And that's where we're at on the south side.
WGN, it is Dane here with you until 5 a.m. In for Nick. He'll be with you again tonight. Dino Tiberi to my right, the physical embodiment of the enthusiasm
of some former broadcaster.
Of Harry Gary, who is the voice of both sides of town. And also, he's the genetic link, the undeniable genetic link to the Nick DiGilio show as the nephew of Larry from Aurora.
Yeah.
Tom Hush is in the booth as well. Now, I remember when this story came out and we talked with, I think, Blockbuster Blake Stubbs, and he couldn't have been more excited about it, MoviePass. And basically what it is, and I'll have Tom Hush add in if I get off track a little bit as far as what it was, but what I understood it to be was sort of a subscription kind of movie experience. There's sort of an all-you-can-eat situation for movie lovers where you pay one fee, and then I think it was almost like unlimited movies or up to a certain amount of movies that you could enjoy at your local theater throughout the course of, let's say, that month or whatever the period was.
One movie a day.
Okay, so you got to go to one movie a day.
One movie a day.
And now, what was the thing? So this is a MoviePass shutting down, looking for a buyer. MoviePass, the Embattled Movie Ticket Subscription Service, shutting down on Saturday. Its parent company, Helios, and Matheson Analytics announced on Friday. Was it kind of like when Red Lobster did the all-you-can-eat crab? It was just they didn't anticipate the amount of movies people would want to go to, or was it just a bad business model from the start?
It was a bad business model from the start because... So MoviePass existed before they went to before they got this kind of notoriety within the last couple of years. But it was much more expensive. It was somewhere, I want to say, at least $30 a month to get that one movie a day.
But for the listeners out there maybe that haven't, there are deals out there where you can get, you know, whether it's dollar shows or $4 shows, but typically movies are pretty expensive. So if you say that was expensive, that's still a really great deal.
Yeah, it was a pretty good deal. But then essentially this new executive came in and tried to Netflix it and make the price too good to pass up. And they made it, I want to say, $9.99 a month. So everybody started subscribing to MoviePass. And the issue was is that MoviePass only had a certain amount of money to essentially beat the average. So they needed to beat the average ticket price in the United States to start making things work. The only problem is that when you have users in places like New York, Chicago, LA, where ticket prices pretty much start at least $12.95 and just kind of skyrocket from there. And that's on like the cheap end for your average theater. Of course, there are theaters like the one I used to work at, the New 400, which is significantly cheaper than the average bear. But, outside of that, there was no way that MoviePass was going to be able to beat that average with the number of subscribers that they were getting. They had a massive amount of subscribers in the beginning. People were using it. It was working. But they were starting to run out of money to cover the loss,
essentially. How did it work? Did they work up some kind of arrangement with the movie theater companies to maybe buy movie admissions in bulk and then do it? Or
no, the way it was working was it was essentially like having a credit card that you would use that would only work for one movie a day. So you were paying to have MoviePass essentially cover your movie. You know what I mean? So you could go to it would cover any regular ticket price, whether it was $8.50 at the New 400 or $12.95, $15 at AMC River East. And the issue was is that there was no way for them to have enough subscribers paying $10 a month that they could have a revenue where they could beat that average of I can't remember.
So it was like a pyramid. You hope you get enough people to sign up that you can still maintain the status of whatever people that specific day were going to the movies and just cover the cost. Because you think about this, like before you get from point A to point we're closing, they could have built in some restrictions because it already seems flawed where you have no, you know, there's such a flexibility in the pricing where maybe it would be. Well, certain theater groups, maybe if it still had a nice footprint around the country, or because there's theaters that we'll go to as a family, we just, you know, choose not to go if it's everybody's going to be $12, where you can either go on a Tuesday and it's $4 or $5, or there's some theaters out there that have like Picture Show in Bloomingdale, they may have other ones, they have first run movies and it's like $5 or something.
Yeah, well, MoviePass, I think in the long term, wanted to create partnerships with large theater chains such as AMC or
they didn't have those in place before. Beforehand? No,
well, because AMC didn't want them. They didn't. They saw MoviePass as a problem, and now AMC has even since introduced their own plan.
Yeah,
which is honestly even better. You get three movies a week. You are not limited to format. So previously, MoviePass, you could only see it had to be like a regular showing. Couldn't be in 3D. Couldn't be that Dolby, the Dolby Cinema, which you can find at some AMC locations or any other special sort of cinematic presentation. It wasn't going to work. It had to be just the regular standard ticket. AMC says, well, why would we let another company do this when we can totally do it better and keep the entire experience in-house? So for, I want to say it's something like $20 a month, you get three movies a week.
Wow.
And you can see any premium format, 3D, IMAX, whatever you want.
It totally makes sense.
Yeah, because free drink upgrades, all this kind of stuff. And they're like, they put MoviePass out of business.
It's terrible. Right.
Well, who needs it?
You'd have to think that would be exactly what you would do. If you're a chain like that has a really big footprint and can deliver on it, you control the inventory on the movie side. You've already had on, you know, MoviePass footing the bill to determine, kind of doing that case study, hey, is there a market for this? There obviously is. And then they're able to come in and just deliver on it, saying like, I mean, it's, I feel bad for the MoviePass people, but I'm not the, well, I think we'll both agree that you and I are both not maybe the smartest people in the entire world, but it seems flawed. Like you wouldn't get into something like that unless you had those like contracts in place with the theaters, or you're giving them something, maybe access to a customer base that they wouldn't have access to. And it just isn't there.
Well, yeah, and their only other recourse was to start selling data, which they probably were anyway. And that's something that makes people nervous. And that would have been yet another nail in a coffin in a time when we were also seeing Facebook get nailed for selling data, essentially. And being, or at least at the very least, being irresponsible with the data that they have. So MoviePass, I mean, think of all the information they have on you. They have your gender. They have your age. They have your viewing habits. All the stuff that Netflix also has, but in a side of the business that's significantly more expensive than Netflix. You know, like they know what movies you're willing to go out and pay for transportation to go to, potentially pay for a ticket to go to, pay for the big soda, the big popcorn to go as a social experience. That's worth a lot of money to certain parties. So
I wonder what they could have done here, because there's nothing that they had as sort of proprietary, because you mentioned some of the bigger chains didn't want them. Of course not. You know, I think it's just
when they could do it themselves.
Not when they can do it.
Because it's not a crazy model. It's a subscription model. It's happening in many other different industries. So why would AMC bother making a deal with MoviePass to make them money when they could just make themselves money? And MoviePass tried to do the restrictions. They would tell you what showtimes you could go to. Some of them, like if it was a really popular movie, say Mission Impossible Fallout, when I was working at the theater, people got blacked out. They were not allowed to purchase tickets with MoviePass. And nothing we did. That was MoviePass's decision. They just turned off the purchasing power for that particular movie.
Wow. You know, and they were saying movies, you know, was going to be something that fell by the wayside unless they could up the entertainment value. They have done that alive and well and obviously out there for people to enjoy. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to wrap the show up. It is Dane here, 720 WGN.